Senate Judiciary Committee, Friday, March 16, 2007, at 10 a.m. at Lewis and Clark Oscar McCarty Building, Classroom 1, Portland, Oregon.
Senator Burdick and the other members of the committee who are here today, it's a wonderful opportunity for our students, for our faculty, and for members of the public to come here to the law school today and hear the hearings on some very interesting bills. So thank you all for coming, and thank you for hosting the hearing here.
Call the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. It's great to have such a great crowd, and I want to tell you how much I and the whole committee appreciate your hospitality coming up here. We're trying very hard in the legislature to, as much as we can, to hold hearings on relevant, interesting issues outside of the building to allow people who aren't able to get to Salem to come down and participate. On the agenda today, we have three items. The first one is the Clean Indoor Air Act, which we actually had a public hearing on in our last out-of-Salem meeting, which was in Eugene. It was quite a lively hearing. And then because you have a very well-renowned animal law section here in the law school, we have scheduled two animal-related bills that we will have public hearings on. These bills will be public hearing only because we already know that there are refinements that need to be made to the bills before we can move forward on it. So again, I really appreciate being here, and we should have a fun morning.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruzanski.
I would like to raise a mild protest. I think it's everyone needs to know today that we're having this meeting in your district, close enough to your house that you could actually walk, where all of us else had to drive up here, and because of that, we didn't get quite as many steps in our competition that we're having. Today's our last day for 6 weeks of walking, and we have a little pediment. So, Madam Chair, we really appreciate having us here at the school, and you got extra steps in where we had to drive.
Senator Pruzanski, we need to stand up and prove that we are in this walking contest. Let's see. I got 8,000 steps on the way here from my house this morning, which is why everyone looks fabulous and I look a little rumpled. Anyway, so we will, on the smoking bill that we're going to start out with, we've had the public hearing, but I want to give people here at the law school who wanted to participate in this a chance to also testify on it. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571. Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 571 relates to smoking. Subject to a number of exceptions, Oregon presently restricts the ability to smoke in public places and places of employment. Each of these terms is defined by reference to an enclosed area with certain characteristics. Senate Bill 571 expands the prohibition in at least the following ways. First, it makes three key definitional changes. One, enclosed areas can be three-sided rather than needing to be enclosed on all sides and can involve permanent or temporary walls as opposed to solid walls. Two, place of employment also includes work vehicles, meeting rooms, elevators, stairways, and certain healthcare facilities. And three, public place now includes any enclosed area open to the public. There used to be several exceptions. Second, Senate Bill 571 prohibits smoking within 25 feet of the entrance, exit, open window, or ventilation intake of any public place or place of employment. Third, Senate Bill 571 eliminates many existing exceptions to the rule that an employer must provide a smoke-free workplace. Under existing law, these exceptions include, but are not limited to, certain tobacco stores, bars, restaurants, bingo halls, bowling alleys, and lounges. All existing exceptions are eliminated and replaced by two different exceptions. One, up to 25% of hotel rooms may be designated as smoking rooms. And two, the smoking of non-commercial tobacco products for ceremonial purposes under the Federal American Indian Religious Freedom Act. Fourth, Senate Bill 571 diverts civil fines collected by the Oregon Department of Human Services for noncompliance from the general fund to the, quote, tobacco use reduction account, close quote. Fifth, Senate Bill 571 enhances the potential penalty against a noncompliant employer from a maximum of $50 a day to $500 a day and a maximum of $1,000 in a 30-day period to $2,000 in a 30-day period. And then finally, sixth, Senate Bill 571 repeals ORS 433.863, which limits a local government's ability to prohibit smoking, and it also repeals ORS 433.865, which allows the Department of Human Services to waive the smoking prohibitions in certain circumstances. There are also then three amendments that will be considered today. The, quote, dash one amendment replaces the prohibition on smoking within 25 feet of certain public places with a 10-foot requirement. A dash six amendment also amends existing ORS 441.815 relating to hospitals. It prohibits smoking in a hospital or within 10 feet of a doorway, open window, or ventilation intake of a hospital. And the dash nine amendment creates an exception for smoke shops. It defines that term, and it clarifies that a smoke shop may sell alcohol in a lounge area between 3 p.m. and 8 p.m.
Okay, we have a witness list on this, and here's what I'm going to do. We have a lot of people signed up to talk on the animal-related bills, which have not had a public hearing yet. So on this bill, I'm going to limit testimony to 2 minutes per person, and then we're going to actually take action on this bill. So we will start out with Paul Spencer from Multnomah County. Actually, we have several spaces here. Why don't we have a bunch of people come up? Paul Spencer, Barbara Zappa, you'll identify yourself. Dylan Hides. We'll start with those three. And if you, for our record, if you would start your testimony by identifying yourself for the record, appreciate it. And any written testimony you want to submit will become part of our record. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Spencer. I live at 2256 Southeast 39th Avenue in Portland. I'm a student here at Lewis and Clark Law School. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 571 and particularly the ban on smoking in bars and restaurants for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think it's a necessary step to protect the health of Oregon's workers. It seems crazy to me that bar and restaurant staff should have to be subject to the dangers of secondhand smoke on a regular basis. I understand that restaurant and bar workers are far more likely, I think 50% more likely, to get lung cancer from secondhand smoke than workers in a smoke-free workplace. Now, people tend to focus on bar patrons and say, if you don't like the smoke, don't go to the bar. But the staff don't have that choice. They need their jobs. Most of them are not in a financial position to be able to quit and potentially be out of work for a long period of time while they find work in a smoke-free environment. And frankly, they shouldn't have to. They should get the same protection as all workers in Oregon. My second reason for supporting the bill is based on my personal experience. I lived in California for a while before and after the ban on smoking in bars was passed there. And I don't have any hard numbers to support this, but I didn't notice any drop-off in business in the bars that I went to. In fact, if anything, the opposite. My friends and I went to bars more often after the ban. There were places we wouldn't go to before because they were too smoky, but that changed after the ban. So I guess just from my own experience, I think that concerns about economic impact on the bar and restaurant owners are overstated. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, and we have, I think we have some written testimony from you, too.
Yes.
So I appreciate it very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Actually, I have one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Spencer, when you lived in California, excuse me, their ban is a statewide ban, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Do you know if they have any exemptions at all?
They had exceptions for bars where the smoker, the owner was a smoker, the staff was, I think, five or less people, and all staff members agreed that the bar could be a smoking bar.
Okay. Interesting. I didn't know that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Good morning. My
My name is Barbara Zappas. I'm the Assistant Dean for Development and External Relations here at Lewis and Clark Law School. I'm also on the board of the American Heart Association and have been an ambassador for the Go Red for Women campaign, representing the Heart Association and advocating heart health for women and promoting prevention and education on the dangers of heart disease. I'm pleased to report that our efforts are making a difference in reaching out to more women who are embracing healthy lifestyles and choosing to live longer lives. And I especially applaud members of the committee who are committed to their own personal health and doing your extra steps. Congratulations.
We're about to fall apart.
I have extra pedometers in my office.
Don't mind me if I'm walking around.
Exactly. You got some time to make up. But I have to tell you, in preparing to speak to you today, I found that I was uneducated about the dangers of secondhand smoke, and I was astonished to learn some statistics. That secondhand smoke causes 3,400 lung cancer deaths and almost 70,000 heart disease deaths in adult non-smokers in the United States each year. And a study found that non-smokers exposed to environmental smoke were 25% more likely to have coronary heart disease. Non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke at work are at increased risk for adverse health effects. And levels of environmental tobacco smoke in restaurants and bars, as was mentioned earlier, were found to be 2 to 5 times higher than in residences with smokers and 2 to 6 times higher than in office workplaces. And secondhand smoke adds to our health care costs. It causes buildup of fluid in the middle ear, causing up to 1.6 million physician office visits per year. Those could all be avoided. Secondhand smoke especially hurts children. Children who breathe secondhand smoke are more likely to suffer from pneumonia, bronchitis, and other lung diseases. Those who breathe secondhand smoke have more ear infections and are more likely to develop asthma and have more asthma attacks. There are an estimated up to 300,000 cases every year of infections such as bronchitis and pneumonia in infants and children under 18 months of age who breathe secondhand smoke. That results in 15,000 hospitalizations. Lewis and Clark Law School is the number one environmental law school in the country. And in our state, where workplace smoking is now allowed, I read that tobacco smoke is a major source of pollution in most indoor air environments, particularly office work sites, and has been classified as a Group A carcinogen by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Tobacco smoke contains over 4,000 chemicals, both gas and particulate matter. Prohibiting smoking in the workplace can have an immediate and dramatic impact on the health of workers and patrons. Bans on indoor smoking have not had a negative effect on the economy. In New York City, a study that found that business receipts for restaurants and bars actually increased almost 9%. Separating smokers from non-smokers, clearing the air and ventilating buildings cannot eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke. Smoke-free workplace policies are the only effective way to eliminate exposure. And smoke-free laws help the 7 out of 10 smokers who want to quit smoking by providing them with public environments free from pressure or temptation to smoke. A month ago, I went to dinner in a local restaurant that was filled with smoke from the adjacent bar. When I asked the waitress how she could work in those conditions, she said, "I keep hearing that they are going to make it so people can't smoke here." So I asked her, "Who are they?" She said she really didn't know. You are they. I am they. As legislators and educators, we can make a difference and positively impact the lives of Oregonians. It's time for us to join our neighboring states and make Oregon 100% smoke-free in workplaces. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good research, too. Yeah. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Dylan Hines. I'm a second-year law student here at Lewis and Clark Law School. As a non-smoker, having to deal with cigarette smoke is more than just a nuisance, it's a safety concern. This has become particularly evident in my life since discovering 4 months ago that my wife is pregnant with our first child. Things that we used to take for granted are no longer available to us. Last week we went to a restaurant in Tigard and had to leave before our food arrived because the smoke from the adjoining tavern was flowing freely into the dining area. It's also hampered my wife's ability to go dancing, something she takes great enjoyment in. She's come to the conclusion that she can no longer dance because she's unwilling to subject our unborn child to the amount of cigarette smoke that one must endure in order to go dancing in Portland.
The last straw for her was last month when she went out with some of her girlfriends and went to dance club after dance club and left each one as each one was more smoke-filled than the last. She did some research and found that one club in Portland where she could, that was smoke-free and she could dance, but the line was so long she couldn't get in. Oregonians such as my wife and myself have for too long lived with the fact that many activities that we enjoy, such as bowling, dancing, meeting friends after work for a drink, come at a price. The trade-off for engaging in these activities is coming home smelling like cigarette smoke, having a sore throat, and if done often enough, long-term health costs. For those people who choose to work in these industries, the price is even higher. So my question to the committee is respectfully, why do Oregonians have to make that choice? I would submit to you that we should not have to make that choice and that by passing Senate Bill 571, you can solve this problem. I was born and raised in Oregon, but like Paul, I lived in California for a while. From 2002 to 2005, I was a middle school teacher, and I had the pleasure of enjoying a state where this type of law had already been passed. And like Paul, I noticed no change in the amount of business. The bars were still packed. The dance clubs were packed. On weekends, you still had to wait for a lane in the bowling alleys. In fact, I believe those places were probably more busy because people like me had no reason to stay home. In fact, could go out and not worry about coming home smelling and not feeling very well. The last thing I want to say on this topic is that something that I believe may be specific to my generation, and that is that many of my peers smoke only when they go out drinking. And I believe this is due in no small part to the fact that these bars are already smoke-filled. But some of my friends who began smoking when they drink began smoking outside the bars and are now full-fledged nicotine addicts. By passing Senate Bill 571, you would make it that much harder for young people to start smoking, and that by changing a system that currently encourages cigarette smoking. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these witnesses? Thank you so much. Very good testimony. Okay. Lisa Mann Million and Courtney Dillard. Okay. Either of you? Okay. Great. Well, we will now get ready. Oh, so we do have one. Okay, great.
If we had another microphone, we could have dragged you up with the first panel.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Senator Burdick and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify. I would like to testify in favor of the Senate bill, and I'm a professional musician.
Could you give your name?
My name is Lisa Mann. M-A-N-N. That's my stage name. My legal name is Lisa Mellion, M-E-L-Y-A-N. And I'm a professional musician. I've been doing it since they made me sit in the kitchen on the breaks because I was too young to hang out in the bar. So I've been in bars, you know, for almost 20 years now. I'm a member of the Cascade Blues Association. I've won the Cascade Blues Muddy Waters Award for Best Bass Guitarist. I've been nominated 3 more times for the Cascade Blues Awards. I was awarded Garage Band's Best Vocalist, Best Female Vocalist, Best Bass Player. What I'm trying to say is I'm a professional. I'm a trained professional. It's not a job I can just go get another job. It's not one of those situations for me. So, but all these years I've been coming home night after night with my clothes just reeking like smoke. I feel sick. My lungs are, you know, full of smoke. My ears, my sinuses. It's just, I feel very passionate about this issue. It's driving me crazy. It's making me sick. I had a friend die of lung cancer. I know what it's like to see someone die of lung cancer. It's a long, slow, and horrible process. My mother has heart disease. I know what that's like to see someone dying of heart disease. And I'm terrified that that's going to happen to me because I sing the blues. And a lot of my friends, they won't come out to see me. They won't come to my shows. I had one friend, he came one time. He wore his leather jacket. He said he couldn't get the smell out of his jacket for 2 weeks. So he never came back to see me. And when I do play non-smoking gigs, there are a few, the place fills up with my friends. And You know, another thing is a property damage issue for musicians and for sound men. Every now and then we have to go in and open up our electronic equipment, our bass, you know, my bass guitar, our guitars, our amplifiers, and we have to clean it out. Because, and you should see some of these things when they've been sitting in a bar for, you know, 5 years, and it's just tarred up and gummed up, and you have to take it to a professional and have it professionally cleaned. So there are a lot of issues for me. This is my skill. This is my life. You know, smoking is just somebody's habit. It's a recreation. It's something fun they do. This is my whole life, is music. And I'm a blues singer mostly. So where am I going to sing the blues? I'm not going to sing the blues in church, you know. And it's going to be in a bar. So I'm not a second-class citizen. And I just feel like anybody that opposes this bill has to look me in the eye and tell me that I'm a second-class citizen. I don't deserve to be protected. So, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this issue. Thank you so much for bringing this potentially to the floor. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I hope if we pass this, it won't stop you from singing the blues.
Oh, no, there's plenty more to sing the blues about.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I just thank you, Ms. Mann, for your testimony. Also, thank you for your musical talent. The blues is one of my passions, and I'm sure you mourn the loss of Paul DeLay.
I do. He was a friend of mine.
Many of us do. Your perspective today was different than I've heard before. We've never had a musician bring this issue before us, and you're right. I'm sure your equipment, your musical instruments are valuable. You have to go through that. And I know what you're talking about leather jackets. I started riding motorcycles with my husband a few years ago, and I was going to buy some motorcycle leathers from someone I knew, and because his wife no longer rode, and he brought it to the Capitol, and it smelled so bad of smoke because his wife was a smoker that I said, I'm sorry, I can't buy this from you, because there's no way to get all of that smell out of the leather. So you're right, and we appreciate your testimony today, and we hope we make it a cleaner environment for you to sing the blues.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Before we move into the next phase, Courtney Dillard, what bill did you actually want to be on?
I meant, and I signed up.
Oh, you did. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, now we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 571, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 571. And for those of you in the audience who aren't familiar with the legislative process, a work session is where the committee actually takes action on any amendments and on the bill. If we pass the bill, if it gets at least 3 votes in this committee, it will go to the Senate floor, and if it passes there, it will move on to the House. So that's our process. Mr. Stanford, we have some amendments. Would you review the -1 amendment?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. The -1 amendment makes a simple change. The existing bill prohibits smoking within 25 feet of certain public places. The -1 amendment replaces 25 feet with 10 feet. That's it.
Okay, Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 571.
Senator Beyer has moved the -1 amendment into Senate Bill 571. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, now we have the -6 amendment. Now, we're kind of going out of order. We've had several amendments drafted to this bill, and the first one was obviously the -1 amendment. And then we had a 2, 3, and 4, and 5 that weren't quite right. So the next one we're taking up is the -6. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. The -6 also adds a new provision that it amends, ORS 441.815, which relates to hospitals. It prohibits smoking in a hospital or within 10 feet of a doorway, open window, or ventilation intake of a hospital, and provides for fines of up to $500 per day per person or $2,000 in any 30-day period. One thing I should note on the dash 6 is that if you look at page 2, line 8, there is a grammatical error that it presently reads, the Department of Human Services may adopted rules necessary. On the versions that the committee members have, the ED should be crossed off to make it grammatically correct. I'm told that this is an acceptable way to handle this, and it would be, if it's adopted, it would be adopted in its proper fashion.
Okay. Can you give me the page number and the line number again, please?
Thanks, Senator Walker. Page 2, line 8.
Oh, I see. Someone is already taking care of
it. It was just a typographical error. Normally, we have amendments. If they make a substantive mistake, we hold off and go back for another amendment, but this is a typographical error. Should have said adopt. They said adopted.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash 6 amendment as corrected in today's hearing to Senate Bill 571.
Senator Walker has moved the dash 6 amendment as corrected in today's hearing, in today's work session, to Senate Bill 571. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator, our counsel, would you go over the dash 9 amendment?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. The dash 9 amendment creates an exception to the smoking prohibitions for, quote, smoke shops. It defines the term smoke shop, and it clarifies that smoke shops may sell alcohol in a specific lounge area between the hours of 3 p.m. and 8 p.m.
Okay. Senator Pruszanski.
Madam Chair, I'll move the dash 9s consideration.
Senator Pruszanski has moved the dash 9 amendment to Senate Bill 571. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to go over the amendment since most of the people here probably have not had an opportunity to see what the dash 9s. We had testimony that was at our first public hearing, which was in Eugene at the Euro Law School. And at that time, we heard from an individual who actually owns a smoke shop or tobacco shop. And after hearing that testimony, I was compelled to bring forward the dash 9 amendments. The dash 9 amendment actually will define a smoke shop as a business that's primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco products and smoke instruments, as defined in these statutes. At least 75% of their gross revenue for the business will have to come from the sale of tobacco products. It will, in fact, prohibit individuals under the age of 18 from entering the premises. It will not allow for lottery, gaming, or any type of betting on premise. If the committee remembers, the individual that gave the testimony talked about having lottery in his establishment. I think after speaking to most of the committee members, we did not want to see this becoming a loophole for bars to be able to somehow stay in existence as they currently are. And so by limiting the, prohibiting, I should say, any type of gaming, and requiring that the primary income come from the sale of tobacco. And the last part on that component is that it needs to be a standalone business, meaning that it cannot be structured in an area like what we would call a mall. So the ventilation system would not be tied into any way in shape or fashion to allow smoke to come out of there. The testimony that we heard in Eugene made it clear to me that when you're talking about smoke shops where you have cigars or pipe tobacco being sold, it's not uncommon for individuals who are buying those items to want to test them or sample them. And it seems only right at this stage in our laws in the state as well as in the country, with tobacco being a legal product, that this would be an appropriate exception to the bill. It should be noted for those that are here, as we heard in the testimony in Eugene, this individual said everyone that worked for them were smokers, because as he stated, it's very important for those individuals to know the tobaccos that they are selling, and it was just basically common known. And so even though we are concerned about making sure individuals who work in employment situations are not directly impacted by smoke where they have no choice, it appears that you're talking about a very small segment of the population that would be seeking those type of jobs, and as he said, all of his employees and himself, that they are in fact smokers. The last part of the amendment would in fact allow for a limited on-premise license for sale of wine and beer type of products from the discussion that we heard again in Eugene. It does require that the area where those type of alcohol beverages are going to be consumed be separate from the main part of the store. It also limits the hours that the alcohol could even be sold on premises if a smoke shop desired to have that as part of their business. And it would be limited to 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. The sense there was for individuals who may be getting off of work and wanted to maybe take the time out, and I felt that it was reasonable to have that accommodation for that little bit. I think the most important part that we need to keep in mind is that the primary revenue source has to come from tobacco, 75%. We're not going to allow any type of gambling to occur, so you're not going to have the lure of people coming in just to gamble and to, quote unquote, smoke, and that the alcohol, if it's going to be available at a smoke shop, that they will have certain limitations as to the type of alcohol that can be served and the hours that it can be served.
Thank you, Senator Poznanski. Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Poznanski has explained them very adequately. I likewise had some concerns after hearing the testimony because, obviously, if you're going into a smoke shop to buy tobacco, you're expecting to smell smoke. So I appreciate the parameters he's put around it. I didn't want these to become speakeasies. And so I think the parameters are good ones, and we will still allow people to smoke a legal product and taste them as they wish, but not subject anyone else to their smoke.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Just an editorial comment here. What you're seeing here is really kind of sums up the difference between the legislative process and the initiative process. If we were to have an initiative on this issue, we would have the original bill.
And so I think the parameters are good ones, and we will still allow people to smoke a legal product and taste them as they wish, but not subject anyone else to their smoke.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Just an editorial comment here. What you're seeing here is really kind of sums up the difference between the legislative process and the initiative process. If we were to have an initiative on this issue, we would have the original bill without the benefit of public hearing, without the benefit of people coming in and telling us things that we hadn't heard. Had you thought about what this would do? Have you thought about what that would do? And so that's just my little editorial comment to be careful what you vote for unless it's been through a process like this. So any other discussion on this amendment? Okay, any objections? So ordered. Dash 9 amendment is in. Okay, now we will take a motion from Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move Senate Bill 571 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 571 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Beyer.
I guess, Madam Chair, I'd appreciate if you would call the roll on this motion because I, for one, will not be supporting it.
Appreciate that. Senator Cruz, did you have...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have comments. Thank you. We've had tremendous amounts of testimony, very compelling testimony in Eugene, in Salem, and here. I sent around a memo, especially after the Eugene testimony, and I just want to share with the folks here in the audience. I was incredibly moved, as I think some members of this committee were, by the testimony of Rebecca Duffy. Ms. Duffy worked as a general manager of a hotel for 2 years. She's never smoked a day in her life. She's had throat cancer twice, and the second time is going to end her life because she has terminal cancer. The doctors, when they examined her, said that her the inside of her body looked like she had been smoking for 15 years, and she had never smoked a day in her life. What was so compelling to me, her words were commendable, her courage is commendable, but she said that when the physicians, my doctors wanted to remove my voice box to extend my life 3 months. I chose not to have this done because I want to speak on behalf of those people that have lost their voice. I get shivers today, Madam Chair, members of the committee, when I read that testimony. I framed her testimony, her entire testimony, on it hanging in my office as a reminder to me that she cares so much about others that she's willing to shorten her own life by speaking out about the dangers of secondhand smoke. So I just, there's no other way to vote here, in my opinion. My colleagues, they're entitled to their own vote and their own opinion, and I hope that the Senate and the House agrees that this is good for Oregon.
Thank you for bringing that up, Senator Walker. And Rebecca has also visited legislators personally in the Capitol. She has two small children. She's just a lovely young woman, and she has made a difference on this issue.
So Madam Chair.
She definitely has a voice. Yes, Senator Pozanski.
I also just want to make a comment that being a resident of Eugene, where we actually do have a smoking ban, we're one of two communities, Corvallis being the other one, that was exempt because we had city councils that put in ordinances before there was a preemption at the state level. And it only seems fair at this time for Oregonians throughout the state to be able to have a opportunity to go to places of public accommodation without having to make decisions, as we heard today, for their health as to whether it's their profession or if it's for entertainment.
Thank you, Senator Pozanski. Other comments from the committee? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
No.
Chair Byer?
Aye. All right. Senate Bill 571 goes to the Senate floor, and I will carry it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
I will serve notice of possible minority report.
Okay. Senator Byer has issued notice of a possible minority report. Okay, a minority report is what that is. If you have two no votes in a committee, as we have here, then the people who vote no have the option under our process of developing an alternative measure under the same subject matter, and then that goes to a vote on the floor. For any of you who followed the rainy day fund that we just voted on in the Senate, there was a minority report on that before the body voted on the main bill. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 571. And before we move into the public hearing on the animal-related bills, we will just do a real quick introduction, which I should have done at the beginning of the committee, so you know who we are. And we'll just start with Senator Pozanski. Introduction.
Okay, well, we're just like notes here as to who's doing what.
I can start with Senator Cruz if you prefer.
My district is Senate District 4. It includes vast portions of Lane County and Douglas County. I've been in the Senate now for 3 years. I was appointed for my first year in the Senate, won in a special election to serve out the remaining 2 years on the term that of the person I was appointed to replace, and have just been reelected, I guess, for a full 4-year term. Prior to that, I had 6 years in the House, and so about 10 years total in the legislature. As I said, the district is a very vast district in the western part of Oregon. It includes all of East Lane County, South Central Lane County, all of East Douglas County, and North Central Douglas County. In fact, Representative Cruz and I, between the two of us, I know we have the largest land mass west of the Cascades. in the districts we have. I have a good portion of Eugene represented within that district, and also very small communities throughout rural Lane and Douglas County. My day job is I'm a prosecutor. I've served as a prosecutor for municipalities or for the state over the last 20 years. And originally from Texas, and my wife and I realized that when we came up here in 1983 for a visit to Oregon, that we were displaced Northwesterners. It took us a year to actually be able to get a job, and we've really enjoyed the opportunity to be part of our community, or to be Oregonians.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm from Mulwala. I represent Senate District 9, which is East Clackamas County, East Marion County, and East Linn County. So my district stretches from Wilsonville in the north down to the Lane County line on the south, all east of the Cascades to the top of the Cascade Mountains. I served two terms in the House prior to becoming a senator. I'm in my second term in the Senate, so this is my sixth regular session, and I have served in six special sessions.
Senator Walker.
I'm Vicki Walker. I live in Eugene. I represent Eugene downtown, North Eugene, West Eugene, university students. Senator Prezonsky and I always argue about who represents more students, but and I also represent Junction City, which is a small rural community just outside of Eugene. Served four years in the House, served one full term in the Senate, and this is my second term in the Senate.
I'm Jeff Cruz, representing Senate District 1, which is most of Douglas County that Senator Prezonsky doesn't have, basically from Roseburg South. Also parts of Jackson and Josephine counties, all of Curry County, and about two-thirds of Coos County. So it takes me close to 4 hours to get from one end of my district to the other. So, but the roads aren't all that good, so you can't go very fast. I served four sessions in the House, and this is my second session in the Senate. Involved mostly health care, education. This is my first FOIA adventure into judiciary.
He is a quick learner. Before I introduce myself, I want to introduce our staff. Up here today is Darian Stanford, who comes out of the Multnomah County DA's office, and before that with Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland. And Matt Kalmanson is around here somewhere.
He was
watching basketball.
Priorities. Yeah.
The truth will tell. And Jennifer Black, who is our committee assistant, and my star legislative assistant, who was well trained here at Lewis and Clark Law School, Natasha Dolezal, who is sitting right up there in the front. And I want to thank everybody at the law school who had anything to do with Natasha's training, because she's been fabulous. So I think I've got everybody. Oh, and me. I am Ginny Burdick, and this actually isn't technically my district. It was my district when I first ran for the Senate in 1996, and now it's represented by Senator Richard Devlin. But I'm in the district right next door, Southwest Portland, downtown Portland, Hillsdale, from which I walked today for the walking contest, and I also represent Tigard and King City and part of Bull Mountain, so it's kind of a far-flung district. I've been in the legislature for 10 years. This is my second session as chair of the Judiciary Committee. I love the committee, and all my members except our newbie, Senator Cruz, are veterans of this committee, and I'm very pleased with the issues that we're able to address. So with that, we will move on to our second bill here, which is a public hearing on Senate Bill 694. Council.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Senate Bill 694 creates a Class A misdemeanor for the restrictive confinement of a calf or a pig if a person does each of the following three elements. One, confines a calf or a pig. Two, for more than 12 hours in any 24-hour period. And three,
in a manner that prevents the calf or pig from either A, lying down and fully extending its limbs, or B, turning around freely, which is defined as being able to turn in a complete circle without an impediment, including a tether, and without touching any side of the enclosure. There are specific exceptions for a calf or pig that is being transported, part of a rodeo or state or county fair, being slaughtered, part of lawful research, being examined by a veterinarian, or a pig in the 7-day period before the pig gives birth. Senate Bill 694 defines calf, pig, and turning around freely, and it applies to the confinement of calves or pigs after January 1st, 2012.
Okay, we have a long witness list here, so they are more brief. You can make your testimony, and if somebody else makes a point and you just want to associate yourself with it, that's fine. So we will start out by with Kelly Peterson and Sharon Harmon on this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Let me just try to get this. Oh, there it is. Chair Burdick and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm the Oregon Program Director for the Humane Society of the United States. Today I'm representing our over 120,000 Oregon members and constituents, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 694. But we're actually, there was a, the word pregnant was left off the original bill, and so the Dash 1 amendment clarifies that. So we had asked for to say pig during pregnancy or pregnant pig. So that's an important distinction, and our comments are directed to the Dash 1 amendment. And so we're really just trying to ensure that pigs during pregnancy and veal calves, those that are raised for food, have enough room to turn around and lie down and just extend their limbs, the most basic movements of all.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can I interrupt? Ms. Peterson, if you're just adding the word pregnant, there's sure a lot of words here, so are you sure you're not doing more than just that?
Well, pregnant in front of each pig.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Well, it was my mistake. I should have had counsel summarize the Dash 1 amendment.
I'm sorry.
Why don't we take a break and have him do that?
I see. I see, Madam Chair. Pig, the word pig is in several sentences. Okay.
My bad. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Chair. The Dash 1 amendment is identical to the original bill, although the legislative council chose to write it all out, I guess, because pig appears there so many times. But in any event, it's identical to everything that we said about the original bill, except that anytime the word pig appears, it's replaced with pregnant pig.
Okay.
Senator Byer. Correction. The definition of pig under in the amendment does not include the word pregnant on line 6.
Okay, some fire with this.
Oh, that's correct. Other than that word pig,
okay,
it says pregnant.
Okay.
Not the first pig, right, but every subsequent pig.
Do we have a definition of pregnant pig, or do we know what a pregnant pig is?
There's not a definite. I think we
yeah. Know that. Okay.
It could be defined if we
a pig
needed it to.
Okay.
I'll just go on to it's a very quick PowerPoint, and though I was up most of last night worried about if this thing would just kind of combust. So there you go. Okay. Recent polls overwhelmingly indicate that consumers are becoming increasingly aware about the conditions on factory farms, and just read a couple. This is a Gallup poll, and it was taken in 2003, and Americans support passing strict laws concerning the treatment of farm animals by a margin of 62% to 35%. And a Zogby poll also in 2004 stated something similar, but more of a massive margin of 82% to 14%. that there should be effective laws that protect farm animals against cruelty and abuse. The issues that we're addressing in this bill is have to do with gestation crates and veal crates. And nationwide, nearly there's 6 million breeding sows are kept in 2x7 metal cages, and they're in crates for nearly their entire pregnancy. And after giving birth, the sows are reimpregnated and forced back into the crates, and really enduring the same cycle over and over again. Veal calves, they're separated from their mothers and within the first few days and placed in individual crates. And inside their enclosures, they are also unable to move. The stalls are really barely larger than their bodies and restricting normal movement. It's so common for sows to exhibit severe stress and neurotic coping behaviors since they can't socialize with others. Renowned world expert, or animal scientist, and Colorado State University professor Dr. Temple Grandin stated at a conference in New York in 2006, the gestation crates for pigs are a real problem. Basically, you're asking a sow to live in an airline seat. I think it's something that needs to be addressed. And I know for me, I imagine putting my dog, who's every bit as social and smart and sensitive as a pig, in a crate for its entire life, and that's really unimaginable. The pig industry is also getting the message from consumers, too. The largest pig producer with roughly 1.2 million sows, Smithfield Foods, announced its decision to phase out gestation crates. Following that announcement, Canada's largest pig producer, Maple Leaf Foods, also released a similar statement that they're phasing out gestation stalls. Two of the largest veal producers as well have also eliminated the inhumane practice of veal crates. And while the market is moving in the right direction, it's still important to implement state policies, closing the door really on these practices. And we wouldn't be alone. Both gestation crates and veal crates have been banned in the entire European Union. National restaurant chains are also responding to their customers. Chipotle is one of the more recent chains to announce that it no longer purchases pork from any suppliers using gestation crates. Oregon grocery stores are also making that decision. Whole Foods and Wild Oats also have crate-free pork policies. Elsewhere outside of Oregon, gestation crates voters actually banned the use of gestation crates in Florida by a margin of 55-45 in 2002. In Arizona in 2006, both gestation crates and veal crates were banned in Arizona by a margin of 62-38. You know, this bill, in a large degree in Oregon, is preventative. There's 4,000 breeding sows here, and there's not a real veal industry. 694 just seeks the most basic principles, you know, requiring that a pregnant pig and veal calves just simply have enough room to stretch their limbs and turn around. And, you know, on a personal level, I can't think of a more perfect time to pass the law. It's good policy. Oregon's want to see animals, even those raised for food, treated with decency. And that's worth ensuring and protecting for years to come. And, you know, a few years ago we had a debate about another issue, and it came into play about the economics. And, you know, at some point we could argue that an issue is too large to address. It's just too difficult. So now really is the right time. And with that, I'll close. And thanks for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Sharon, did you want to speak?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society, a separate organization from the Humane Society of the United States. But I am here today to testify in support of this bill, and I think Ms. Peterson did an excellent job of laying out the issues. I remember as a student at Oregon State University, let's just say a long time ago, and seeing the hogs and the veal calves in these crates and was horrified to see that. And to know it still goes on today, and that we have an opportunity to reflect with this bill the values of the community. Oregonians care deeply about animals, and I believe that should this bill become the, you know, as it was in the front page of the Oregonian, I hope you got the calls and letters that reflect those concerns. If you were to take a horse and treat it like a veal calf, or a pregnant sow, it could be a felony crime in Oregon. We understand that sensibility, that respect, the freedom to stand up, turn around, and move without touching a surface or laying in your own waste are the basic elements of a community that is respectful and compassionate to those who can't speak for themselves. In closing, I just urge your support of Senate Bill 694.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, Kendra Kimbrowskis and Court Schreiber. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, good morning and thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Kendra Kimbaraskis and I'm co-president of an organization called Friends of Family Farmers. We are an all-volunteer citizens group working to promote socially responsible agriculture in Oregon. Through education and advocacy, we promote family farming, healthy and sustainable rural communities, and citizens having a voice in the siting and construction of industrial factory farms that have the potential to impact rural communities, public health, and the environment. Friends of Family Farmers is just over a year old, and already we have over 100 supporters statewide, many of which are family farmers and rural residents that span the state from Pendleton to Ashland and throughout the Willamette Valley. On behalf of Friends of Family Farmers, I have traveled here today to ask you for your support of Senate Bill 694. Oregon is predominantly a state of family farmers and ranchers. Because of Oregon laws that were put into place to protect those family farmers and ranchers, and because our laws don't differentiate between small, medium, and industrial-scale farms, more and more industrial farms are looking to Oregon as the next frontier of industrial animal agricultural production. The majority of Oregon farmers and ranchers produce animals in a way that is humane, doesn't pollute the environment, and is respectful of neighbors and the local community. However, that is not the case for the majority of industrial factory-style farms. Factory farms profit by standardizing the production of animals. Pigs, chickens, and cows are confined by the hundreds, if not thousands, in barns where they are often prevented from even seeing the light of day. To minimize labor, the majority of factory farms use a liquefied manure system, meaning that the animals, for the most part, are not bedded down like would be the case in a more traditional farm. Instead, animals stand and lie on concrete floors, and their manure is flushed out into giant holding ponds called lagoons. There, the waste is not treated as a municipality would treat the same type of organic material. Instead, the manure is held in a liquid state where it seeps into the ground and releases tremendous amounts of gas, such as hydrogen sulfide and ammonia, which are not only noxious to neighbors, but can make people sick and reduce property value. With industrial farms moving into Oregon at an unprecedented rate, and because the state exempts agriculture across the board from having to comply with the state's basic air rules, Senate Bill 694 could encourage an operator to evolve and use a system that isn't just good for the animals, but puts practices into place that are profitable, could be better for neighbors, and have a less impact on the environment. A few weeks back, I had the pleasure of traveling up to Ephrata, Washington to visit the farm of the Klingemann family. The Klingemanns produce nearly 20,000 pigs per year and do so by growing them in a system called a deep-bedded hoop house. This is a design where the pigs are bedded down with straw so the smell is minimal, and there is no liquid waste product that runs the risk of getting into the waterways or the groundwater. In addition, like would be required by Senate Bill 694, the pigs have the ability to interact and socialize, so they aren't stressed and don't require growth hormones or antibiotics to reach market weight, providing a product that is often highly valued by urban consumers. My visit to the Klingemans farm was part of a tour hosted by a company called Cornerstone Systems, which is hoping to bring pork production in eastern Oregon into full swing. Cornerstone, in conjunction with Hill Meats of Pendleton, is looking to produce 350,000 pigs per year within just a 200-mile radius from the city of Pendleton. However, their plan is to do so, is to not do so in a way that confines their animals to crates, but uses the system that I described earlier, the deep-bedded hoop house. This is just one example of how a company can think outside the box and produce a product at a large scale and do so in a way that minimizes the impact to local community, to the local community, to the neighbors, and is humane for animals. Centerville 694 is not a solution to the vast array of problems associated with the factory farming model of producing animals. With the growth of the industrial farming industry in Oregon, it is imperative that Oregon lawmakers take steps to ensure that our environment is protected and that neighbors' health, quality of life, and property value are not diminished. Another step that should that the state should take is to remove the exemption for agriculture from Oregon's air rules and put a system into place that empowers the Environmental Quality Commission to regulate emissions from factory farms. I hope that you will not only support Senate Bill 694, but that you and your colleagues will work to ensure that family farming in our state remains profitable and that rural residents and communities are protected from the threats posed by the industrial factory system of producing animals. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a family farmer. Why have I never heard of your organization before today?
As I mentioned, we are about a year old. We organized largely because of the influx of the industrial farms that are moving into the eastern part of the state. So you probably will hear from us in the near future.
Madam Chair, I would like to have a list of your membership, if you could provide that.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, we are a non-member organization. We have supporters, and we don't make our list public.
But you will submit your testimony.
I will submit my testimony.
A follow-up.
But you will submit your testimony.
I will submit my testimony.
A follow-up. I'd just like to say for the record that animal waste streams in Oregon agriculture are regulated. They are controlled. And they are done in very, very environmentally friendly ways. And I was involved way back when that was tasked through the Department of Ag to Soilwater Conservation Districts to deal with any issues we had as far as complaints. So to say that this is just random happening out there without regulation is absolutely untrue, because it is regulated.
May I respond?
Please.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you are correct that regarding water, we do regulate farming operations through the Clean Water Act in the state. However, air quality is not regulated. Agriculture is exempt across the board from having to comply with any of the state's basic air rules.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Okay. Mr. Schreiber.
My name is Corey Schreiber. I'm the founder of Wildwood Restaurant here in Portland, a 13-year-old restaurant that focuses on, and thank you, Chair and Committee, for having me also. But we focus on sustainable foods, organic foods, and animals. And I'm really only going to speak on behalf of some local chefs and how much time and energy we put into studying the facts of how the animals are raised. We have direct relationships with farmers. And really, the point that comes to my mind is the consumer point. In other words, from a business standpoint, I have noticed over the last 13 years in Oregon, and I'm speaking from an urban standpoint, I suppose, because we're dealing with diners and white tablecloth restaurants, which I realize is somewhat exclusive, but it also is a public that drives a demand for how we access our product. And in the case of animals, we spend a fair amount of time going to farms, trying to find out, you know, what is the healthiest, what is the most sustainable, and what is the kindest way for them to be raised. Whether it is, you know, terms come up these days, which is quite funny when we have to answer questions about, is it grass fed, is it grain fed, you know, what is the land that it comes from. But I do find that a consumer interest you know, was somewhat limited in the retail sector because so many things are packaged in plastic and broken down to small cuts and somewhat unrecognizable once they reach that state. We happen to bring whole animals into the restaurant and break them down ourselves. And one of the other things that's happened over the years, I think in the case of veal, always kind of prized for its tenderness, and that is somewhat driven by the fact that it doesn't move very much, if at all, that the public has moved away from that a little bit because chefs have learned to take whole animals in and to learn how to braise meats and learn how to fabricate and how to apply cooking techniques to meat that don't rely on them being so tender and having them confined, and that's somewhat of a prize point. It's not for us, in other words. I think that the consumer and the public is changing and realizing that they want to know where their foods come from, where the animals are raised, how they're raised, and then once they arrive in the kitchen, such as Wildwood or many other restaurants in Oregon, you know, what we do to bring that to the table. So I'm just stating that consumer awareness is very high. I'm questioned on that frequently in a public place where we're dealing with people that are obviously paying a fair amount of money for these items, and I'm just stating that awareness is on the rise and endorsing that and hopefully bringing it to your attention that the public is a business point from a restaurant standpoint. And also, as they brought up the point, Whole Foods, Wild Oats, New Seasons, all these mass stores obviously are paying great attention to answering these questions because we have an obligation to do so, and it does make a difference in terms of how we're preparing the animals. Also, when you talk about quality factors, flavor, and what we can do to present this in a way for human consumption that is thought backwards to how did it start, how did it get here, and then how did it arrive on somebody's palate. I think these are important issues and more than they ever have been in the last 20 years. And I've been cooking in Oregon. I started my career here about 30 years ago in a hotel where these weren't issues and nobody asked these questions, and I'm glad that they do, and hopefully I've assisted by answering some of those for you today. So thank you.
Very much. Do you serve veal at Wildwood?
In the last 13 years, maybe twice over 13 years, and that's just for one special on one night, so 98% answer no. Pork, we do serve pork. We bring in the whole animals. And we do, in fact, just had a tasting 2 weeks ago with our supplier and asked some very specific questions about how the animals were raised and where they were from and how they were fed. And so we do spend a lot of time investigating this. And the main reason is because we want to know, because it affects the quality of the product, but also, as I've made, the consumers want to know also, and it impacts their decision to dine in a particular restaurant or shop at a particular store.
Thank you. Question, Senator Byer.
Thank you. So, with the steps you've taken, wouldn't you say the market is pretty well taken care of this issue?
The retail and just the wholesale market?
Just the market in general. We saw a list of stores, farms have voluntarily done this, and you said your own restaurant, you're doing it. Consumers are educating themselves, apparently, because they're asking about it. So hasn't the market taken care of this issue?
Well, until the bill passes, I would guess maybe not. I mean, I'm not as familiar with that system, but to answer your question, yes. I think the market has done an excellent job in educating the public that wants to know about these issues in terms of food source and food handling and so forth. But the market has done an excellent job. But I find there's a lot of gray area there, too. If 150 people eat in a Wildwood restaurant any given night, I would say that maybe 60, 70% of those people might be curious about these. So I think there's still always work to be done to continually get the information out there, because there is a lot of distortion. We deal with a lot of issues.
Follow-up,
please.
Thank you. Doesn't this give you a marketing advantage to some of your competitors, maybe, if they aren't educating the people or taking the steps you have? Doesn't this actually help your business, then, to bring in the conscious, savvy consumers, that they know that your restaurant is, treats animals a certain way or insists the animals be treated a certain way?
The clientele that we're dealing with, I would say yes. You could say it's an educated, inquisitive clientele that has the ability to source these foods. But then if you say competition, I think the drop down is pretty far when it comes to food quality, maybe in the fast food sector or the mass produced sector, where they have to buy things for much less and sell them for much less. And I think that that market is a little bit disturbing because it's off the cost of doing food at that level, I think, is very harmful. And so I'm not mentioning names, but I think when you get into that sector that needs to buy pork at 60 cents a pound, there is an issue. And I think that's maybe a case where, you know, money needs to be saved in order to bring the price down, in order to provide it at a very, very low price. But the true cost of doing business at that level from a health standpoint is pretty dramatic, and we see impact of that also. But I would agree, we are unique in terms of our clientele and our marketing advantage and our access to talk about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll have Walt Burke and Brian Scott and Jerome Rosa.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Walter Burke. I live at 34231 Southeast Holman Road in Gresham. A little bit about myself. We have a 10-cell herd at home. I'm past president of the Oregon Pork Producers. I have a 28-member swine club in Clackamas County, Gresham area. And I'm also the overall livestock superintendent for Clackamas County Fair. We have this issue on the Senate bill. It touches on a couple different things. It also touches farrowing crates. We use farrowing crates in our herd for when the sows are bred. A week before they're due, we put them into a farrowing crate, which is a lot like a gestation stall. They have slatted or wire floors underneath them, so the feces all pass through, so they're in a clean environment. The animal can stand up. She can move forward. She can move back. She can lay down on her side, fully extend her legs out to the side, roll over, whatever she wants to do. The reason we use farrowing crates is one is to protect the little ones. When I first started in the business 26 years ago, we farrowed in a box pen, probably 10 by 10. We had bumpers around the edge so when the sow would lay down, she would not lay on a baby pig. We lose anywhere from half to three quarters of a litter due to crushing because the baby pigs, when they're born, walking around in straw, shavings, whatever, when they're first born, they can't get away from the sow. So when she lays down, they can't move, so she crushes them. So therefore, we'd lose half a litter. So in order to stay in business, we looked into other things, and we come up with the farrowing crates. I now maybe lose one piglet per litter due to crushing because the pigs can get away. She can slowly lay down and everything like that. One of the other aspects of it is after they're weaned, or before they're weaned, when they're in the crates, they have to be, navels have to be doctored, they have to be given iron shots because they're iron deficient. Some producers clip mule teeth and stuff like that. To do this, the cell is very protective of her little ones. The farrowing crate offers myself, my herds people, protection when they're grabbing baby pigs. You don't have the sow chewing on your leg and, you know, taking chunks out of you. So therefore, from that aspect, it's not only beneficial for me, but it also it protects the baby pigs because she can't get to them when she's up and jumping around and everything like that. So that's one reason we use the crates. And then the other one is, like I said, if we don't use the crates, we would lose, like I say, half of our litters, and to me that would be a financial impact on, you know, my farm and that. So I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Did you use these for a week before and then until the piglets are weaned?
Yes, we put the sows in the crate to get them used to being in the crate a week before. That way it gives them a chance to just relax and get used to the new surroundings. and then when they feral, we usually keep them in there for another 3 weeks, just so the little pigs can have a chance to get sea legs underneath them, learn what mom's about. We can keep direct heat on them to, you know, keep them warm, and because a baby pig has to be kept at about 90 degrees, and so we have heat lamps and gas brooders going on them. And then in about 3 weeks, we take them out and put them on the floor in a bigger pen where they have bumpers and that. And then the cells in confinement, or being in the crates like that, after we do wean, they go back out into bigger pens. They're out there, we rebreed. 5 months later, they go back into what we call our farrowing room, where our crates are, and the pigs go right back up into the crate. They don't balk. They just, they go back in, walk up the ramps and in the crates, and are content to be in there. They know that that's their home to, for the next 3 or 4 weeks, so they can have their baby pigs.
So the little piglets get weaned after 3 weeks, so they never spend time with the piglets when they're not in the crate.
I don't understand your question now.
After, you said they get weaned after 3 weeks?
3 to 4 weeks. At 3 weeks, we take them out of the farrowing crates, the sow and the babies, put them into a larger pen where they can all move around freely. And then it's another 2 weeks before we usually wean. We usually wean at about 6 weeks of age.
Do you think the way you do it, from based on your knowledge, is different than the way a factory farm would do it?
Most of the factory farms that I know do use back east. The pictures I've seen, a lot of them, this is where this bill kind of, it has two sides. It's got gestation stalls, which is completely different than farrowing crates. Gestation stalls is where they're in there from the time, my understanding of a gestation stall is from the time they're bred till the time they get ready to have to farrow. Then they will go from the gestation stall into a farrowing crate. But this bill here that you're asking to be passed also touches on a farrowing crate, because it does confine the sow to the 2-foot by 7-foot, like a gestation stall, and then it has outer sides on them so the baby pigs can't get away. And so that's why I'm here speaking on behalf of the farrowing crate part of this, because on this part of the bill, is because of the farrowing crate issue. It will take that into consideration too.
But if the bill were changed to just deal with gestation crates and not the farrowing,
I would not have a problem with that, because as the industry is, it is moving, like Smithfield Foods and the rest of them, it is moving to get away from those.
Thank you very much. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Those are really good questions. I was wanting more information about that. The previous witness, young woman, Ms. Kim Braskis, she talked about an alternative method, and I really didn't understand what that method was, and I couldn't see, I'm a visual person, I couldn't see it written down. Do you know anything about what she was talking about?
No, I don't. I haven't, not using gestation crates or gestation stalls. I do not know what all the industry is going to. I just know that they're gearing away from that over the next few years.
Okay.
On the gestation stalls.
And the manager, can I follow up? The gestation stalls, you don't use those.
No.
Do you know how long they, you said that they put the pig in there from gestation and they stay in there until they deliver?
That is my answer.
5 months? How long do they gestate?
Pigs have a 115-day gestation period, so it's 3 months, 3 weeks.
3 months standing in this stall?
Yes, that's my understanding. Like I say, I'm not an expert on gestation stalls. There's several other people that I know that are here that can testify on gestation stalls for you.
115-day gestation period. Thank you.
Thank you. Your testimony is very helpful. Okay, Brian Scott.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning to the rest of the distinguished members of this committee. My name is Brian Scadozzi. I serve as Executive Vice President of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for the American Veal Association, a nonprofit 501c4 corporation. In addition, as a second-generation family farmer, I represent over 3 decades of personal family farming in our industry. I'd like to thank you and each member of the committee for holding this important hearing today and allowing me to testify before you. The American Veal Association represents now over 1,000 family farmers in 12 states throughout the Midwest and Northeast. Our constituents add nearly $1 billion per year to the economies of these commonwealths and nearly $350 million per year in direct purchases from the U.S. dairy industry.
The average veal facility houses only 250 calves. 20% of our producers are Amish and Mennonite. Therefore, we truly represent small family farming in our nation's agricultural economy. We stand today in opposition to Senate Bill 694. We strongly believe that the practices mandated by this bill, without appropriate accompanying research, would in fact pose a risk of harm to the animals its proponents seek to protect. The proposed requirements relative to the welfare and care of pre-ruminant calves are in direct conflict not only with the overwhelming majority of available scientific data, but decades of hands-on, day-to-day experience as well. Faced with similar but more expansive legislation in 2003, the New Jersey Department of Agriculture commissioned its land-grant university, Rutgers, to perform a study on the science of veal calf production. This study addressed the production requirements espoused in this bill under consideration today and concluded without exception that the proposed requirements of Senate Bill 694 were without scientific merit and would actually prove harmful to our calves. The study also focused on other industry practices not germane to this bill and, again, upheld veal industry practices without exception. I have submitted to the committee the complete study performed by Rutgers for the written record. In recent years, New Jersey, Illinois, California, Massachusetts, and even this great state, Oregon, once presented with the facts, have refused to enact legislation similar, if not identical, to Senate Bill 694. In addition, federal legislators have also had an opportunity to consider this issue, and again, similar measures have been dismissed by the United States Congress each and every time they've been offered. The mandates of this bill are simply not supported by sound animal science, as evidenced by the fact that not one bill of this kind has ever been enacted by any legislature in this country. To quote the conclusions of the Rutgers study, according to the scientific studies and evaluation of existing practices, calves raised on veal farms are well cared for and have their nutrition and health needs met. The study goes on to state, the measures under consideration are all contraindicated for optimal veal calf health. Tether systems are not stressful and are beneficial for veal calves, as shown repeatedly by both university research and practical observation. Iron levels are maintained above minimum levels on veal farms to assure adequate health and performance while meeting consumer demands. Digestible fiber is not recommended for veal calves because of well-documented health requirements. The study concludes with this statement. These kinds of legislative measures may bring about more significant, but not necessarily animal-friendly measures in the management of domestic livestock. What you'll hear today from the supporters of this bill are emotionally charged arguments and sound bites based on outdated and, in most cases, untrue assumptions, but you'll find very little in the way of peer-reviewed animal science. If these special interest groups want to change our science-based production practices, then we'd ask the burden of proof be placed squarely on their shoulders and not once again on the backs of hard-working family farmers. We respectfully ask the chairperson and the committee to support the family farmers of Oregon by opposing this legislation. Thank you again for holding this important hearing and allowing us to participate in it. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
You said that the arguments and sound bites are based on outdated information and untrue assumptions. Are you saying that the industry has changed over the years, or is there a difference now in how these animals are treated than some years ago?
We're constantly updating and changing our welfare and production methods. We have what we call the VQA, or the Veal Quality Assurance Program, that was started in 1994, and on it sits a panel of veterinarians and university nutritionists who constantly make recommendations to us on different ways of production. So yes, a lot of the information that I have seen in testimony before talks about practices that were possibly germane in the 70s or 80s but are no longer used. However, we still do tether our calves, even in group housing environments. And the gentlewoman from the Humane Society pointed out that a couple of our major producers are moving towards group housing. They still tether the calves for the first 8 weeks while we're in what we call the nursery environment, where their immune systems are still being developed, where they're given their vaccines, and while they're learning to co-mingle and socialize.
These veterinarians, or these experts that you bring in addition to the quality of the meat, do they consider the quality of life for the animal when they're making these recommendations?
Rutgers study, absolutely, and here in California, Dr. Carolyn Stahl, who's a renowned animal welfare expert, was the lead author in 1993 of the University of California Davis study, and that's all the state of California charged her and the university with, was looking at total animal welfare.
Okay. Questions for the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, your turn.
Good morning, Senators. It's my pleasure to be able to testify today. My name is Jerome Rosa. I'm from Jervis, Oregon, which is just about a half hour south of here. I'm a fourth-generation dairy farmer. My wife and family and I, we milk about 300 cows just south of here, like I mentioned. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in ag education with an emphasis on dairy science from Cal State Fresno. I'm on the Oregon Beef Council, one of two dairy representatives in the state on that. And I'm currently the president of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. But probably the thing I'm most proud of is we're starting our sixth year of being an organic dairy farm here in Oregon. I often get asked about the care of our animals and how dairymen care for their animals, and this is an important issue we're talking about today. And when I'm asked that, I always comment to people that not only do I, but every dairyman I know take better care of their animals than they do themselves. I have a nutritionist that's out every 2 weeks looking at the rations on all our animals throughout the herd. While I'm drinking Diet Pop and eating onion rings, I wouldn't feed that trash to my animals. I've never had a nutritionist look at my diet, and yet we scrutinize every feed that comes in. We test it for quality, and we make sure those rations are balanced, and we do that regularly. I have a hoof trimmer that comes out twice a week, if needed, sometimes twice a month, but on schedule twice a month every time, but sometimes he'll be out as much as twice a week. We're trimming nails. We don't ever want to see a long nail. We don't want to see a lame animal, because a lame animal is not a productive animal. The barns are clean twice daily, which is very common, some even more than that. So there's no fecal matter there, because quality milk is what our consumers want, and that's what we get paid for. We have a veterinarian that comes out every month, goes through the whole herd. We have a computer data system that has been in place for over 15 years on the farm, which is very common for producers these days. Talking about our calf raising a little bit, the key to raising calves is they have a clean and dry and well-ventilated environment. And there's lots and lots of ways to do that. Ours is kind of we have several lean-tos with curtains on them, and we can adjust the ventilation according to the time of the year and you know, if it's cold, we have them down and that type of thing. And where there's fans in there, and this is really common throughout the industry. We're trying to cut down on respiratory problems and to be able to keep those animals clean and dry and well fed. A newborn heifer calf in the dairy industry is worth over $500 now. One cow, the market price is over $2,700. So I've known producers that have literally been out all night to take care of a sick animal, because you have a huge economic impact there. And at $500 for each animal, you sure don't want having anybody getting sick and not doing well. Oregon dairy industry has about 320 dairies in the state now. And my wife and I started our dairy in 1988. We came up here from California. We started on a shoestring. And today, in today's environment, I don't think we'd be able to do that. And there hasn't been very many that have gotten started. The numbers of family farms are dwindling. Why are they dwindling? Well, there's lots and lots of issues that are involved, but the biggest thing has got to be the frustration level with the increased amount of regulation that we have. We have CAFO issues, which are great, but I mean, it's a tremendous cost that cannot be passed on to the consumers. And our producers are required to do these things, and they want to do these things. They want to do the right things. But at conventional prices, there's not the money in the community to be able to do these kinds of things.
Can I break in here for a second? Do you feel that your operation would even be affected by Senate Bill 694?
Well, and I was going to get to that at the end of my testimony. Our industry, there is language in there as far as like tethering, as far as animals, you know, being able to touch, for instance, in hutches to where when they make circles sometimes, you know, calves would be able to, you know, would be touching the outside. But the reason why we're here is that it starts to be a slippery slope. Senator Beyer touched on it really, really well when he spoke in that the industry is taking care of these issues. There's consumers that want organic milk, they want BST-free milk, they want, you know, and they'll have regular conventional milk. It starts to, if this were to go through the way that it is, it gets to be a slippery slope on the regulatory effects that it has on our industry. And with this kind of language that is in this bill, it's very easily could be misinterpreted and be a detrimental effect to our producers. The tethering, you know, for instance, it's not uncommon for calves to be in hutches that are tethered, and that could be interpreted as what this bill does say. In closing, 2 years ago there was over 100,000 dairies in the United States. Currently, there's less than 70,000 of them. We're small, we're going down, our numbers are dwindling, and the more regulation that we put on these producers, the more difficult it makes for them to do business. And it's in their best interest to raise healthy animals, and that's what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, all three. Okay, now we've heard substantive testimony on both sides of this issue, and we have a fairly long list of people who are yet signed up to testify. So to make sure that everybody gets to speak, if you would keep your comments short, and if your point has already been made and you want to associate with it, that's fine. But the shorter the better, and then we can get everybody who signed up done. So we will have Isaac Cohen, Kim McCoy, and Danielle Thompson.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm Isaac Cohen. I live at 21082 Southwest Meadow Way in Tualatin, Oregon. I'm a student at Westland High School. Right now, in one of our classes, we are studying factory farming. One day during class, we watched a video about the pork industry and how the animals were treated. Most of the students were appalled. Some were even crying. I can easily say that hundreds of fellow students and other youth would support this legislation out of environmental concern and sheer respect for the animals. I myself feel as though to treat an animal in this way is inhumane, but I also understand that this decision cannot be made on emotion alone. That being said, it is a decision that has been made in other states and even other countries. Germany, for example, has adopted a much more radical legislature that says that pigs need to have toys to play with and space to roam around. This system has been proven to work, benefiting both the animal and human community. You may and have heard arguments today that it is actually better for the animals to be caged. This, however, has been proven to be untrue time and time again. The animals are not protected from the disease that is rapidly passed through closely packed confines of a factory farm. They are so cramped and unstimulated that they will actually go insane from sheer lack of activity. that cannot even get away from their own excrement, many times developing serious infections from bacteria from their own feces. And in cases where there are slates to keep the feces away from them, the piglets may actually get stuck inside these inside the openings and not be able to get to the their moms to get milk. I think that we can all agree that these things are not good for the animal. To keep it short, I speak on behalf of many students today when I say that I support Senate Bill 694.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kim McCoy. I live at 24010 Northeast Tree Hill Drive in Wood Village, Oregon. I'm a third-year student here at Lewis and Clark Law School, editor-in-chief of the Animal Law Review, and a law clerk at the National Center for Animal Law. I just want to say what a pleasure it is to have you right here at our school. It's very nice of you to be here. Before I start, I just wanted to address a concern that a gentleman who spoke before me brought up. He seemed to believe that Senate Bill 694 would affect farrowing crates. And I just wanted to call to your attention, my understanding is that Section 3F actually exempts farrowing crates from this bill, and I just wanted to bring that to the record.
Thank you for pointing that out.
I came to law school because I believe that all animals should be treated humanely and with respect, and I think that society should enact laws that protect animals from abuse. I bought a home in Oregon last year, and I plan to stay here permanently after law school. I grew up in rural Tennessee, and as a child, my mom took me one spring to visit some piglets at a local farm. And I remember that distinctly because the farmer let me hold and pet the piglets, and they ran around the barn, and the mother pig was rooting around in her nest, and it was such a wonderful experience. I don't think a lot of people realize the way pigs are raised now. I know that at that time I had never heard of gestation crates or farrowing crates, and I'm sure my mom hadn't either. And I think when most people think about pigs, they think of happy pigs kind of wallowing in the mud or basking in the sun out by a barn, and they don't think they would be horrified if they saw the conditions that these pigs actually live in. And this is also true for veal calves. In fact, in the 30 years or so since the American public has become aware of how veal calves are raised, veal consumption has dropped by approximately 85%, and I think that speaks volumes. While I personally choose not to eat animal products, I know many people who I do know really care about where their meat comes from, and people are willing to pay a higher price for animals if they believe they were treated humanely while they were still alive. And we've seen evidence of consumer demand driving this, businesses large and successful like Smithfield and Maple Leaf Farm that are voluntarily phasing out these practices and moving into group housing instead. In addition to being kinder to the animals, evidence suggests that these practices may actually be economically beneficial as well. In fact, just last fall, the Animal Law Review published an article on this topic, and I've brought copies for all of you to take with you in case you're curious, which I'll leave on my way back to the table. So, Madam Chair, committee members, you have an opportunity to set Oregon forth as a leader on this issue and to show the nation that Oregonians do not tolerate animal cruelty. And I urge you to vote yes on this measure. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome, committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danielle Thompson. I live at 37 Northwest Trinity Place in Portland. I'm here as a concerned member of the community to voice support for Senate Bill 694. I'm also a third-year law student here at Lewis and Clark, and taking the Oregon Bar in July. I plan to stay here. I came to Lewis and Clark Law School for its animal law program and to work for better protections for animals such as this. I also don't eat meat, and part of the reason I gave it up is because I was appalled when I learned about cruel practices on modern farms, such as the restrictive confinement that this bill seeks to address. Pigs and calves, like human beings, have the ability to feel pain. And just as I wouldn't want to be confined in a space so small I couldn't even turn around, I don't think, given the choice, they would either. And you've heard from others about what this strict confinement does to pigs and calves, and I can tell you from personal experience that I was an exchange student in Thailand where I stayed in a room for 3 months where from my twin bed I could touch all four walls, and that definitely made me stir crazy. And of course I could come and go as I pleased from that room. But in conclusion, it's my opinion that this kind of imprisonment is inhumane and unnecessary. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said the 3F would exempt a farrowing crate, but I think the way this is written, I don't read it that way. It says that a pregnant pig in a 7-day period before the pig farrows would be exempt. But that doesn't, number one, does not exempt farrowing crates. And number two, if you keep the pig in that crate for a 12-hour period, in any 24-hour period, the day after it farrows, you would be in violation of this ordinance or this statute.
May I respond? Senator Beyer, I respectfully disagree. It's of course I would certainly defer to your judgment, but it does seem to me that Section 3 says that Subsection 2 doesn't apply to a pig in that 7-day period. So that means that the 12-hour confinement wouldn't, or that Section 2 is the section that covers the 12 out of 24-hour period.
Madam Chair, I would agree that in the 7-day period prior to farrowing, it wouldn't apply. But as was testified, the pigs were traditionally kept in the farrowing pen or crate for up to, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks after the pig farrows. So this bill, as drafted the way I read it, would be the from the day that the pig farrows on, it would apply.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Any Lewis and Clark people, students or faculty who are against Senate Bill 694? I want to make sure if we run out of time that we get all the Lewis and Clark folks. Okay, I'm going to take another panel of anybody against it from Lewis and Clark? Okay. Trying to find here. We'll take Claire Tonry, Alexis Fox, and Paul Walker. Okay. We'll take Alexis Fox, Paul Walker, and Wayne, Monica Kerslake. I'm trying to guess here who's from Lewis and Clark here. Let's see how my guessing is. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Alexis Fox, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My address is 942 Southwest Dolph Court, Portland, Oregon. I'm a first-year law student here at Lewis and Clark, and I am here to support this bill. Thank you so much for coming to our school today. This is very exciting to have you here. Before coming to law school, I wrote a thesis on social marketing and the animal protection movement. While some of my focus groups involved people of my parents' generation, my research was mostly focused on people of my generation. And one truth that my research uncovered is this. My generation cares about where our food comes from. Specifically, we care about the manner in which animals are raised for food. Our growing concern for better animal care standards already impacts American society. We can find evidence of this expanding public opinion in the demand for humanely raised animal products on college cafeterias throughout the country. on TV stations such as Animal Planet and on the carton of egg, cage-free eggs in the grocery store. Today, you have the opportunity to show my generation that the Oregon state government recognizes our concern for better animal care standards. You have the opportunity to speak to this concern by improving the standard of care for pregnant sows and veal calves in Oregon. Better animal care standards will become increasingly important to the American public in the years to come. And this bill is a chance for Oregon to lead the way. Please vote in support of this forward-minding legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Paula Walker, and I live in Clackamas County, 62049 East Jetview Lane, Brightwood, Oregon, located in the foothills of Mount Hood. I'm a second-year law student at Lewis and Clark, and I support Senate Bill 694. I thank you for allowing us to have a say today. I speak today not from the position of a law student, but from the position of a mother. I've raised my children to have a respect for all of life. Our family shares a keen focus on the value of the animals, as well as the people that comprise their lives and their well-being. I do not believe that as a society, we can continue to live a double standard in which we teach our children about the values for a civil society and convey to them that they must treat everything around them with respect and care for the well-being of those entrusted to their caretaking, while at the same time continue to countenance the inhumane practices of the farming industry. It really isn't necessary that the food of our tables, for our tables, comes at the cost of prolonged pain and suffering. Animals, that is, animals raised for food, can and should be handled humanely and allowed to experience their basic physical needs, just not only for food and water, but also for movement and association with other creatures. In short, they should be allowed to live normal lives. They're not simply or merely input-output machines that are eventually dissembled for consumptions. There are creatures that have a complex emotional and physical nature. And just in short, we cannot justify subjecting sensitive creatures to a whole life of torture to have meat on our plates. One does not have to come at the cost of the other. With this bill, we can provide at least a step toward the means for animals to have a good life, as well as giving us the benefit of the food that we get from them. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Monica Kerslake, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. My address is 3422 Kinsrow Avenue, number 148, Eugene, Oregon.
You're my constituent.
Duly noted.
I'm a second-year law student at the University of Oregon, and last year I founded our Student Animal Legal Defense Fund, and I came here today because this is a really important issue for myself and other students at the law school. I agree with many of the points that have been made here today in support of Senate Bill 694, and I just wanted to say a couple of things about it to keep it short. You have heard that other states in this country, including Arizona and Florida, have passed legislation banning the inherent cruelty of gestation crates and veal crates, proving that these systems are outside of America's moral sensibilities. You've also heard that grocery store and restaurant chains such as Whole Foods, Wild Oats, Chipotle's, and New Seasons Market have made the socially responsible choice and have chosen not to buy products from factory farms using these abusive crates. Simply, welfare treatment should extend beyond the bare minimum of the economic sustainability level. And clearly, if these practices are too inhumane for producers such as Smithfield Foods that you've heard is phasing out the crates themselves to support, surely it should be too inhumane for the state of Oregon to support. Common sense dictates that it is cruel and inhumane to confine animals too small for them to even turn around or have a chance to touch their own young. Only through legislation can we ensure that all animals and farms are treated more humanely, and that is why I would ask that you pass Senate Bill 694.
Thank you very much. You. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Pazansky.
I believe an individual that you called by name is here now.
Oh, okay. Here's what we're going to do now. We're running out of time, so I'm going to take two more pork producers, and then I'm going to invite anybody from Lewis and Clark who hasn't already testified to come up here and testify on this bill. Then I will recess the hearing and pick up a couple dairy people and anybody else in favor of this bill who's not from Lewis and Clark, because I want to make sure we get the testimony on the other bill that we have on the agenda. So that's how we'll operate. So we will now take Claude Williamson and Nanette Bierma. Welcome to the committee.
The chairperson, Murdoch. I read the information on the website of how to address this committee, and I've gone blank. Hello, chairperson, senators.
We're a very informal committee.
My name is Claude Williamson, and I have a farm out at Maupin. And I don't want anyone to think I'm a factory farm, but I have I'm growing my herd to 200 sows, and I should be marketing 3,000 market hogs this year. And I want to note I'm a producer for a New Seasons market. I've also been a director of the pork producers in Oregon for a long time. I'm also a member of the National Pork Board's Animal Welfare Committee. That's been five years there, and a small group of us were selected to go on a fact-finding tour of Germany and Denmark. I'm against this bill as it's written, and as I read F, we're not going to allow the use of fallowing crates after the pig is born, and so that's why I'm against this bill primarily. In Europe, I had an opportunity to see the German producers and the Denmark people. They're very good producers, very competitive. They do a very good job. They do not use gestation crates. And I like to make sure everyone understands the terminology. A gestation crate is after the pig is bred. They're put into a crate, probably for 90 days or so, probably 2x7. And I've heard other people testify here, and I think we're mixing terms up somewhat. A farrowing crate is where you generally put the pig 3 days, 4 days, 5 days before she farrows, and generally leave them there for 21 to 30 days. Different producers have a little bit different philosophy after they farrow. In Denmark and Germany, they require them to be there a minimum of 21 days because they don't like the idea of early weaning of baby pigs. Here in the U.S., some people will wean as early as 15 days. But that's the common practice here in the U.S. is 21, 22 days is a real common number. The other thing about Germany and Denmark, and I really was surprised, they put them into a breeding crate, and we don't really do that a lot here, but they put them into a breeding crate. It's designed a little bit differently. It's easier for artificial insemination. And then they leave them there for about 28 to 30 days. And the reason for that is they want that semen and the egg to settle. And I don't know all the scientific jargon there, but if the sow goes out and joins the other animals and get into a fight and squabbles, they'll either lose their breeding or their numbers are reduced. So potentially a lot of their pigs will have 11, 12, 13 pigs per litter. That's a pretty good number. In the U.S., Smithfield Foods has announced that they're going to discontinue use of gestation crates over a 10-year period. That's going to put a dramatic pressure on all the other producers here. They have about 30% of the market here in the U.S. So, and I was recently at a meeting in Dallas of the Animal Welfare Committee meeting, and we all agree gestation crates are going to be out. 10, 20 years, they will be out. They'll be, everyone's going to be forced out. It's going to become a marketing issue. If Smithfield Food can say we have all the hogs out of this plant are free of gestation crates, then they're going to have buyers coming to their doors. So I'm sitting here today looking at this bill about the gestation part, and I'm thinking, I don't really care if you pass it or not. I think it's almost going to be a moot issue by the time it comes into effect. And currently in Oregon, I'm not aware of any producer that has a gestation crate. So it wouldn't affect any current producers. So that's where I am on that part of it.
Can I ask a question here, Madam Chair?
Senator Walker.
Thank you. This is informative testimony, Mr. Williamson. In your testimony, you say in Oregon we have 300 or more people with one or more sows.
Yes.
So you would call those the producers you just talked about? You said you don't know of any producer that...
None of those producers that I'm aware of have any gestation crates. I've been on the pork board, or the state board here for probably 15, 20 years. I've never heard of anyone with a gestation stall in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, a good number of us have farrowing crates. I'll get to the statistics a little bit. The government, we're really a very small state. In the U.S., we produce 102 million hogs. Smithfield Food has about 30% of that. In Oregon, we produce 17,000. That's a significant, we're just very small in the large scale of things. We have two large, and we call them large producers in Oregon. They're really very small by national standards, but they produce they're processing about 3,200 hogs a week. Now, there's some other producers. Or other slaughter plants here. But the interesting thing is that virtually 75% of those hogs are coming from Canada and about 25% from Washington State. And on a footnote, about half of the Washington State pigs are bought as feeder pigs out of Canada. And I wanted you to get a scale of the competition. Here in Oregon, we're very, we're not in a very good position to be competitive, mainly because of our high cost of feed. So, if you ban farrowing crates here in Oregon, I believe it's going to put our small industry at a great disadvantage. If I raise 3,000 hogs this year, that's my hopes, and we had a ban in place, I'd have 600 hogs that probably wouldn't make it. From all the information I can gather, if I do a good job, we'll have about a 20% additional death loss in farrowing crates. And so this is my real concern, that I want to be able to continue using farrowing crates.
And you're talking about if we keep the requirement in that you can't use them after the hog farrow.
After they farrow, we need 30 days is what we need. And that would capture all the things. There's a few variations of what producers do, but that would capture all of us, or a good share of us.
But the provision in there for 7 days before they farrow, that works.
That works, yes. Truthfully, I'd probably put mine in about 3 days. And different producers do a little different things.
Madam Chair?
Senator Kuzanski.
So for our range, if you said 7 before, pre, and up to 30 after...
That would work.
Would you support the bill at that point?
I wouldn't be adamantly opposed to it. There's a question about the breeding, and I don't know... See, we've never done very little research about that here in the U.S., and I don't know quite what that means. The Danish people really think it's great. And the German people have the same provision where they allow for 30 days for a breeding period. Now, I haven't installed them yet. We're trying to grow my operation so my daughter can move, can join the farm. That's what we're trying to do. We're putting in something called a freedom stall. That's where an animal can come and go if she chooses. And I've seen those in operation in Germany. And the amazing thing about it is the animals choose to spend 30% out freedom and about 70% of the time in the stall. Now, what's even further amazing, and the sow tends to go back to the same stall she came from. It's like, this is my apartment, I'm going back.
Huh.
It's that was the most amazing thing I learned on this trip.
Can I ask another question?
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really getting an education in animal husbandry. How quickly do you if the sow is pregnant again?
We try to do it, we hope to do it in about 7 days. It varies a little. We wean a sow, and generally 5 to 6 to 7 days she'll come into standing heat, and that's when we breed them. Sometimes it'll take 10 days.
Okay, well, see, that's the concern I see here, because if you use a breeding crate and the sow is in the farrowing crate 7 days before,
yes,
30 days after, and then you impregnate them.
No, oh, I'm sorry. The moment we wean the sow, about 7 days later, she's impregnated.
Yeah, and then they go back in a crate again?
No.
Okay. Well,
not in Oregon.
Oh, if,
not
okay, in Oregon, you're saying if we had a breeding crate.
Right.
Right. If we had a breeding crate, it would be, okay, let's add it up. It would be 7 days, let's say 30 days for farrowing. It wouldn't be that, not all producers would do that. That's 37 days. You'd have about 7 days and they get bred, and another 30 days.
Okay.
That would be the total. And that would be the high.
How often do you breed these sows over and over again? How many times?
As long as they'll produce and do a good job for it.
Could be years.
The industry doesn't really keep. I tend to get attached to some of my girls, and I hate to say it, but I've kept some of them longer than I should. I think, well, let's give her another chance. Let's just do it one more time. I think as a small, I have 200,000 people think I'm big. I really tend to be a small producer. From a national side, the national hog, if you're at the national level, people think of a family farm as 500 sows. And so, yeah, I do think that maybe I shouldn't, but I tend to keep them. But
I'm just trying to get a perspective,
yes,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, how often they're bred, how long they'd be caged in, and that sort of thing. Because I know nothing about pigs other than my grandmother had one when I was a kid, and I used to go feed it the slop left over from the dinner table and everything else, and it was always kind of stinky out there, but that's,
yes,
that's all I remember.
We need to get from
here. Yeah.
All
right.
There's one more aspect to this bill. I think if you turn, I had a handout, and there was a second page that
we have it.
There is a worker safety thing that I don't think anyone quite understands that, but a sow with her babies is a very protective animal. And there is a danger, and I wanted you to see there's an article there about a lady that was attacked.
Be careful.
Yeah, and she, you know, I say she did something sort of stupid. She opened the crate, and I shouldn't say that. I've done the very same thing, and my daughter's done the very same thing. We're trying to assist the sow. And she, you know, I say she did something sort of stupid. She opened the crate, and I shouldn't say that. I've done the very same thing, and my daughter's done the very same thing. We're trying to assist the sow. We open the back door so we can reach in and work around the sow. It's very possible it could back right out on you and come after you. It doesn't happen very often, but it could happen. And I'm experimenting right now with raising pigs without a farrowing crate, because I mentioned I sell the New Seasons, and they're asking me if that's practical and what it would cost me. And I jumped into this pen not thinking, because I haven't had that experience with sows that are free, and this sow bit me right on the rear when I reached down and grabbed one of her pigs. She just came right up and grabbed me on the rear. Now, fortunately, I was big enough, and I yelled, and she backed off.
Yeah. Mr. Williamson?
Yes.
Is that one of your favorite girls?
Not anymore.
All right, sir. All right, the committee has to shape up here. Okay, we need to conclude this.
Okay, there is one more thing I want to point out. The National Pork Producers have a new program called SWAP, and this does not address gestation, but it says that anything you do in the pig, in raising pigs, you have to do a good job. Animal well-being is very important, and there's 9 principles there. A lot of it's, and the funny thing is, we find out a lot of people are simply not trained. They simply don't know. There's not enough farm kids anymore. We're hiring people out of cities, so there's a strong emphasis on training. But the SWAP program, the main, and it's being implemented starting July. In 4 to 5 years, we expect to have most of the hog farms signed up for it. And at that time period, the major packing plants have all agreed, I don't want to call it collusion, but they've all agreed that they're going to require a person selling pigs to them to be certified under the SWAP program. And so the industry is taking action in several areas. There's 9 of them listed that we want to make sure welfare of the animals. And we realize it's good for business and it's good for public relations.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Byer.
One question, Madam Chair, and I don't know if you would know this or not, or if you have employees on your farm, but if you do, do you know, are there OSHA requirements that regarding farrowing pig and whether or not that pig has to be tethered, caged, or something to, in order to protect the worker?
I don't know if there's any requirements about that, but it does. When I read this report, and I knew that people have been injured by pig, but when I read this about this lady, I begin to wonder about OSHA. I have my daughter, her future husband, and another employee. I have three employees right now, and that definitely has gone through my mind. It's been a little concern.
You might ask our counsel to check that out, Senator Brown. That's a good question. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we have your written testimony. We need to just very quickly summarize
okay.
it, or we won't get to our next bill. Thank you.
As you see before you, I've requested a letter from, I'm sorry, Minette Birma. I'm a swine producer here in Oregon, Woodburn, Oregon. I have about 15 sows. I do not even use barren crates, do not use gestation crates. But believe me, there have been times I wish I had one on the place. The place that I have set up was that way to start out with, so we went with the pans that they had. I've had over half litters crushed because not every sow is like that, but there are a number of them that are, that just, they'll just go down and, you know, you have some sows that react and they will come back up if they're squishing a baby, but death loss is very definitely an issue with not having the ability to use farrowing crates. And like I said, I only have 15 sows. It's me and my teenage kids. And truthfully, I just did my taxes. We lost money this year. So I guess I'm a hobby farmer right now. I have been looking into getting a few farrowing crates and using them with particular sows that tend not to be as, I don't know, good mothers. I don't know if that's the right word. But I am also a 4-H leader, and my kids are also involved in FFA, and very definitely feel that it is a safety issue when it comes to unexperienced kids going out buying their sow for their first time, are not used to the change, the hormonal change that's going to happen when all of a sudden you've got a protective mom and those babies, and you have to vaccinate them, give them shots, iron shots, handle them. For kids to be able to go out and do that safely, really recommend them to use a farrowing crate because they just don't have the practical experience of having a 700-pound animal coming at you.
Okay, well, thank you for coming. And we have, for the record, some information that you requested from the OSU Extension Service, and that will be very helpful.
One more quick introduction, if I can. We have a producer that is in the Men Angel area, and he has graciously offered you guys, they've used farrowing crates, about 100 sows, and if you'd like to come take a farm tour and see what they actually look like, see a farm in action, your committee, you're more than welcome to.
We might do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Make sure the staff has that information.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Of course, she's...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this time, I'm going to open up the dais here to any Lewis and Clark faculty or student who wants to come and testify before we close this hearing and get on to the next bill. And needless to say, we have to be very quick.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, thank you for taking this time. I'm going to address the economic considerations of this bill really quick.
Can you give us your name, please?
My name is Claire Tonner. I'm a student here at Lewis and Clark. Thank you. I think that consumers and producers both stand to benefit in multiple ways from the Senate bill. First of all, it has been shown to studies around the world that switching from gestation crates to alternative methods, namely group housing using an electric sow feeder technology, decreases production costs more than enough to offset the cost of switching technologies. And there's methods of doing this that can further make this a profitable switchover of technology. It also significantly increases productivity for the farmers. Given the nature of U.S. demand for pork, these savings are likely to be passed on to consumers as well. The reasons that the electric sow feeders, which are increases efficiency, have not been introduced into the U.S. is generally just industry inertia and lack of familiarity with the technology. But the industry in Oregon is already changing, as people have already testified. And this Senate bill will correct these inefficiencies and these forces of inertia and lack of knowledge. And that's going to benefit both ends of the market. Everyone has been saying that this technology or the phase out of these crates is coming, and this is only going to help further this process and get us to these benefits even faster. In addition, there's a growing niche market for more humanely raised meat. A surprising number of Americans, not just vegetarian meat eaters, are concerned with farm animal welfare. People have already testified on this point as well. Free-range products, Whole Foods humanely raised logo, are evidence of this demand that is growing. Whole Foods logo just came out. They're finding this to be profitable. Consumers also have been shown to relate these humane rearing methods to health and food safety concerns, even when they're specifically told that it's not related. I did my own research as an undergraduate and honors thesis and consumer survey addressing this is one of the concerns that came up. So this further feeds this growing market. People are finding that more humane methods are translating into health benefits for them, and they value this. The average person in Oregon values and is willing to pay more for better animal husbandry. The average willingness to pay, for my study, found that Lane County residents, the average Lane County resident, will pay a significant premium for more humanely raised pork products. The study was strictly controlled to reflect the value of humane treatment only. So these added benefits of perceived benefits for health, as well as the increased quality and taste and texture of the meat, is not reflected in this, and this is going to add a lot more to this premium that consumers are willing to pay.
Okay, can you wrap it up in about...
Bottom line, sure.
Thank you.
The bottom line is that producers are going to save money, they can charge more, and consumers are still, even after this premium is charged, going to benefit. So I think this is a win-win situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Next.
Hello, my name is Bethany Cotton. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for this opportunity. I'm a second-year law student at Lewis and Clark, also a lifelong resident of the state of Oregon. Just a couple very quick points, and I will lend my support to the testimony of the other students and supporters of this bill. First, to the safety concerns raised by the industry representatives. The bill does not prevent use of crates altogether. It simply prevents use of crates for more than 12 hours in a 24-hour period. Thus, the concerns of FFA students or young people or of employees of the farm in terms of safety in feeding times and also in times of giving immunizations are not necessarily implicated. At those times, the crates may still be used under the terms of this bill. However, the animals may not be left in those crates for more than 12 hours in a 24-hour period. So those safety concerns should not prevent you from passing this legislation. In addition, contrary to what the gentleman from the veal industry said in terms of lack of scientific peer-reviewed studies that go to the benefits of these not using these confinement procedures, I would point you specifically to the article in the Animal Law Review that Editor-in-Chief Ms. Kim McCoy offered to you. I am the editor of that specific article, and there are numerous studies cited, that all of which occurred in the last 5 years, that specifically go to both the economic and the animal welfare benefits of not using these confinement techniques. And they are peer-reviewed academic studies that are cited in that article that deal, in addition to Senator Walker's specific concern about the hoop barns, there's a specific article about the use of hoop barns, that alternative method that is cited in that article, and I would point you to that to learn more about the use of that technique. So for those reasons, I would encourage your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Wayne Geiger from the Lighthouse Farm Sanctuary and president and founder of the sanctuary. We're located at 7500 Wallace Road.
I'm going to have to defer your testimony because you're not from Lewis and Clark, and I will reopen this hearing if we have time.
Oh, okay.
We're going to take, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. I hate to cut anybody off, but we are in a time crunch here, and we have another bill that we need to get to today. Okay. So thank you for your patience. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 694, and thanks to everyone, and thanks for the patience of those who didn't get to testify. My intent will be to reopen the hearing if we have time after discussing the other bills, but for now we're closing the hearing on Senate Bill 694. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. Council.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, ORS 686.455 requires the veterinarian to report aggravated animal abuse to a law enforcement agency anytime the veterinarian has a reasonable belief that such abuse has occurred and the veterinarian has either, one, come into contact with the animal, or two, come into contact with the person suspected of committing the abuse. Aggravated animal abuse involves either the malicious killing or torture of an animal under ORS 167.322. ORS 686.465 provides civil and criminal immunity for any veterinarian who in good faith makes such a report. Senate Bill 1017 expands this duty to report in two significant ways. First, it adds the reporting duty to include the crime of animal neglect in the first degree, ORS 167.330. This crime involves, with at least criminal negligence, failing to provide minimum care for an animal in the person's control and, as a result, the animal suffers serious injury or death. Second, Senate Bill 1017 expands the reporting duty from just veterinarians to include any public or private official. It defines this term, public or private official, to include only the following: psychologists, social workers, foster care providers and employees, counselors, and marriage and family therapists. It provides that such officials are not required to report if the basis of their suspicion involves a communication that is privileged under Oregon law. There are presently such privileges under Oregon law for psychotherapists, social workers, counselors, and public officers. Senate Bill 1017 would apply only to suspicions based on contact on or after the effective date of the bill. There is a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1017. That amendment is the same as everything I've just summarized, except for there is no addition of the crime of animal neglect in the first degree, a duty to report that offense. It would be limited solely to aggravated animal abuse and would expand the classes of persons who would need to report that crime only.
And, counsel, what this would basically do, as I understand it, is for those who are already required to report child abuse, those people would also be required to report aggravated animal abuse. Is that correct?
My understanding is that the connection that was drawn with the public or private official, those were the classes of persons that were there were trying to capture.
Okay. Thank
you
very much. Senator Prezant.
Just a clarification from counsel. My understanding from what we've been told, this would be mandatory reporting, as the chair said, would extend it to individuals who already have that duty as it pertains to child abuse. I guess my question, it really comes down to the part of where there's exemptions. And using the example of a psychologist or a clinical social worker, if they're in a setting with a client and it is disclosed to them something that they believe would be animal abuse, it appears that they would be able to rely on the whatever exception they may have under existing law for confidential testimony.
Communication.
All right, and then so if they were at the grocery store and they heard someone over talking about some type of conduct that could be interpreted to be animal abuse, they would have to take the steps as they would under child abuse?
Yes. That's a short answer. Yes. Okay. Senator Prezantsky, my understanding of the bill is because they became aware or suspicion, they
developed a reasonable suspicion of aggravated animal abuse, and the basis for that suspicion was not a privileged communication they would be obligated to report.
Maybe a clearer example would be if they saw some type of conduct inside the parking lot that they thought was reached that threshold, then they would have a duty to report.
Correct.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Cruz.
I'm slightly confused at this point because this is a separate inclusive commingled but not an inclusive list of mandatory reporters.
Let's take a little of the testimony and see if we can...
Because we're mandatory reporters everything except I don't see us listed here. Are we included in this?
That must be a terrible oversight, Senator.
Well, I mean, I'm just wondering...
No, and it was my understanding that the intent was to get the mandatory reporters also covering child abuse or animal abuse, and the mentality behind this bill was that oftentimes children who are being abused can talk about animal abuse, but they can't talk about their own abuse. And this is, and also that the correlation between people who severely abuse animals and people who severely abuse children. That was kind of what led to the bill. I personally think aggravated animal abuse is its own crime and is very serious, but the reporting requirement has a justification in the area of child abuse as well, because oftentimes the folks who will severely abuse a family dog, oftentimes they're severely abusing children in the home as well. So why don't we start out with our, and I hate to keep rushing through here, but let's start out with Scott Heiser and Kelly Peterson and Sharon Harmon. I think we'll start out with Mr. Heiser because have an interesting journey to this issue. Mr. Heiser, you were a prosecutor before you got involved in the animal law area. So
that's very true. Thank you, Senator Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Scott Heiser, H-E-I-S-E-R. I live in Corvallis. I work in Portland and Corvallis. I now represent the Animal Legal Defense Fund. I'm a former prosecutor, 17 years of experience. Over eight years as the elected district attorney in Benton County. I'm here on behalf of the ALDF today, 115,000 contributing members nationwide, to support Senate Bill 1017 with some suggested improvements to the bill. Recognizing what Senator Burdick said moments ago about the driving force behind this bill, there are some things that need to be tweaked. Senator Prozanski's point about the privilege is a good one. This bill also needs to address, where's my note here? Oh, yeah, here it is, OEC 405 sub 5. That's the provision in the evidence code that says that privileges for psychotherapists, doctors, and other members that enjoy such privileges under the code can waive the privilege and affirmatively report when certain really bad things are about to happen based on their otherwise confidential disclosure by their client or their patient. That language limits itself to crimes against humans, and that needs to be changed so that there is actual reporting of those professionals when there are crimes against animals. Then you get actual reporting. This bill has teeth and it works. The other point I wanted to make, is a continuity argument, and going back to the child abuse mandatory reporting statute, it requires, well, actually it imposes a Class A violation penalty for those people who don't report. This bill, and I think that we ought to fix that aspect of Oregon law rather than water this one down, but this bill makes it a Class A misdemeanor not to report animal abuse. Current Oregon laws, it's a Class A violation not to report child abuse. So we've got a proportionality argument that needs to be addressed as well. Those are my two...
We have a bill, Madam Chair, in your committee about that.
to fix that one?
To make it a Class A misdemeanor?
Yeah, well, it just does many things. It's left over from last session, but it could be used to fix that
problem. But you make a good point that it would be irrational to have a higher penalty for reporting animal abuse than it is for not reporting animal abuse than for not reporting child abuse.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Potenza.
No history here. The first cases that were for child abuse were actually brought in New York State through the enforcement of animal abuse.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Before we protected the theory there was that the property had value and a child did not.
Correct. Mary Ellen Williams, I believe, is the famous case where the SPCA came in and addressed child abuse in the construct of animal welfare statutes that were already on the books. Since we're short on time, I think I'll limit my comments to just those with one other additional point to clarify, and that's with respect to the pool of people that are obligated to report in this bill isn't as deep as the pool for child abuse. It excludes attorneys. And there's political reason for doing that, I understand, but I just wanted to make sure. If the intent is to be as broad in scope as the child welfare statutes are, we're not there yet. There's some tweaking that needs to be done.
And that addresses Senator Cruz's concern as well. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1017. And I will say, I think I was also testifying last session on this bill, and I really do appreciate Senator Burdick's attempt to bring it back and seeing if there is some sort of place that everyone can get to where I included also just some materials for you, some documentation of cross-reporting laws and agency reporting from other states. And there, I think there's about a dozen or so. So you have that in your packet along with a lot of our material dealing with First Strike, the link between animal abuse and human violence. So I know as well we're short on time, and I didn't know if it was appropriate to maybe read through some of the studies, or it's also in the material. So
we have your handout for the record, and I think what I appreciate your understanding, because we do have some folks from Lewis and Clark signed up.
Right, and I imagine a lot of people will recite the same statistics that we have, and it's in our materials as well. So with that, I'll just close that with some of the suggestions that were made. We also
Sharon.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon, Director of the Oregon Humane Society and not associated with the Humane Society of the United States. I think that's my new tagline for today. We are here in support of Senate Bill 1017. We have three full-time cruelty investigators that work statewide, and we have found is that often people are far more eager to report animal abuse than child abuse, because when you go into some of these homes, what you find is what has been happening to the animal is what has been happening to the children in the home. We think the more eyes on animal abuse results in more better stewardship of all of those who can't speak for themselves. With reference to Senator Przanski's comment about humane societies protecting animals and children in their early days, that was certainly true of the Oregon Humane Society in 1868. We were established to protect draft animals. Our mission shifted to children, and here we are with animals, and we're back again today to talk about that interconnection between the treatment of animals and the treatment of children. The more eyes we have out there, the more reporting, the safer our kids are going to be. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz, while you were out of the room, Mr. Heiser made the same point you did, that this bill lacks the breadth of reporters, and so that was a good catch on your part. Thank you very much. Now we have Kim McCoy, Alexis Fox, and Professor Doug Belouf.
Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Alexis Fox. My address is 942 Southwest Dolph Court in Portland, Oregon. And I'm going to be reading a statement from a good friend of mine who wanted to be here today. She's an abuse victim. So if that's all right with you, I'll just read her statement. My name is Diana Wiener Rosengard, and I write to you today as an advocate for victims of domestic violence and as a supporter of Senate Bill 1017. I apologize for being unable to attend this session. I'm currently volunteering as a restraining order room advocate for Multnomah County. As an advocate, I am aware of the correlating statistics showing that in 88% of domestic child abuse cases, there's also animal abuse. But I write today not merely to share statistics, but to share a personal story of abuse. As a child, I was abused by my father. I tried during my teenage years to obtain help through a number of traditional avenues. Teachers, school counselors, local community leaders, friends, and parents of friends. I finally escaped at the age of 18, but I left behind a younger brother. While my brother and I suffered abuse, the abuse did not end with us. My father would also take in animals who were later severely neglected, including a German shepherd that died of starvation and heat exhaustion. At the same time that this dog was starving, my little brother lived in a house with no food, electricity, or even running water. My father would leave and return randomly, sometimes gone for hours or days. My brother loved that German shepherd and was caught several times trying to obtain water for the dog from a neighbor's faucet. If someone had noticed and reported the dog's neglect, perhaps we also might have been helped. While my brother narrowly escaped with his life, the dog did not. Through Senate Bill 1017, we can encourage better reporting of animal abuse and at the same time provide yet another safety net for victims of domestic violence. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, once again for the record, my name is Kim McCoy and I'm a third year law student here. I'll keep my testimony very brief. I would just like to say that this issue, this bill, is very important to women, children, animals, and anyone who suffers or has suffered abuse or neglect. The link between domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse is very well documented, and as such, I've dropped off a couple more law review volumes with articles on that topic for you to review at your leisure. And I support Bill 1017 and ask that you vote yes for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll put the law review articles in our record. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Doug Baruff. I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark, and I run the National Crime Victim Law Institute, which is an institute for crime victims, human crime victims. There are two central reasons to support this bill. One is simply being
several times trying to obtain water for the dog from a neighbor's faucet. If someone had noticed and reported the dog's neglect, perhaps we also might have been helped. While my brother narrowly escaped with his life, the dog did not. Through Senate Bill 1017, we can encourage better reporting of animal abuse and at the same time provide yet another safety net for victims of domestic violence. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, once again for the record, my name is Kim McCoy and I'm a third year law student here. I'll keep my testimony very brief. I would just like to say that this issue, this bill, is very important to women, children, animals, and anyone who suffers or has suffered abuse or neglect. The link between domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse is very well documented, and as such, I've dropped off a couple more law review volumes with articles on that topic for you to review at your leisure. And I support Bill 1017 and ask that you vote yes for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll put the law review articles in our record. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Doug Ballouf. I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark, and I run the National Crime Victim Law Institute, which is an institute for crime victims, human crime victims. There are two central reasons to support this bill. One is simply being decent to the animals listed as animals who can be subject to these criminal laws. But if one isn't persuaded by the need to be decent to animals, hopefully one is persuaded by the need to be decent to human beings. And as others have testified to, there are numerous studies that correlate child abuse and animal abuse. There are also numerous studies that correlate animal abuse with extremely violent crimes outside the family to adults as well as children. So any improvement that you folks on this committee and your colleagues can make in reporting on abuse to animals not only does the humane thing for animals, but provides greater information and greater potential for protection for human children as well as human adults. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify in front of the committee. I would join Scott Heiser's comments about the cleanup pieces that need to be made. Actually, I know Scott, and since I know him as a district attorney, I have to apologize for not recognizing him in his new role, but I'll make up for that after the hearing. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I know your time is short.
Thank you. We've got the law review articles. Are you aware of other kind of peer-reviewed information that you could bring up for the committee?
I wrote an article myself that included a study of the links between animal abuse and violence to humans, and there's a long list of such studies, so many that some are collected in edited editions of book volumes, and I'm happy to provide those to Jennifer.
Maybe we could just start off with the one that you wrote, because I imagine you cite the other.
I do cite all of them, so I'll provide copies to her.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Are there questions from the committee? We knew going into this hearing that this bill was very much a rough draft. We worked on it several times last session and weren't quite able to get there with something that we felt that was clean enough. But it's back. We're going to try again and see if we can make something out of this.
If there is resistance to the attorney lobby in being included, you know, I would be happy to be an advocate on the other side of that should that become an issue. Talk to anyone who is expressing those concerns. My observation is that this bill is much less of a concern because the crimes that it specifies are so narrower and so precise than sort of the generic child abuse reporting. So in my view, this bill should be less problematic for reporters than the other bill is.
And it's also worth noting that the mandatory reporting also provides immunity for reports that are made in good faith. So it actually is a vehicle for letting people do the right thing without fear of legal consequences.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I would just like to tell Professor Bluth that part of the problem here is that I've been trying to address for a couple of years now is there is no training for mandatory reporters, no required training. Unless you're an attorney, we now, as members of the legislature, have training because I ask the Senate President, and so we get that training every session. But there is nothing in state law that requires mandatory reporters to have training. If they don't know how to do their task, then it's really hard to follow up and make sure they're doing it. And that's the issue that we face.
Well, I would support, you know, we've been going through that as lawyers for years, mandatory training. One of our credits, I think, is that right?
Yep.
Is on that. I think I just took one. So this could be readily folded into that training. Since we have that training every year, frankly, we've heard it I don't know how many times. Might be nice to have some fresh material in there.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1017 And we're going to very briefly reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 694, and we'll take two witnesses, the gentleman who was cut off before, and Jim Cron, we will take for comments. We're a little past our time. If we can get this done in 5 minutes, I think my committee might forgive me. Welcome. We'll start off with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this opportunity to address the committee. My name is Wayne Geiger. I'm the president and founder of the Lighthouse Farm Sanctuary. We are located at 7500 Wallace Road Northwest in Salem, Oregon. We are dedicated to rescuing, abused, and neglected farm animals. One of the things we do that is so important for the work of the sanctuary is, I know it's a little different than as the producer's point of view, but we offer tours and events at the sanctuary where we allow, it could be schools, churches, retirement homes, disabled people, families, and at-risk children come out to the farm, and they get to see animals in a natural setting. These farm animals only all come from formerly abused or neglected situations. But one of the connections I want to demonstrate to you hopefully today is that these people do not normally get to see their food, for one. They do not normally get to see their animals, farm animals, in a natural setting demonstrating natural behaviors. One of the things that gestational crates do not, and veal crates do not allow for, is natural behaviors such as nest building. Pigs do like to nest build. They like to graze and run, and some of the pictures I have here to brought for you today are pictures of our pigs from situations that vary, but they show them in a natural setting. When the children that come out to see these animals get to see them in a natural setting like this, they have no idea that an animal even likes to do these kind of things. One of the other aspects that is oftentimes overlooked is simply like the two larger pigs in those pictures have never been sick a day in their lives. They are not confined. They are not in a concentrated living condition. They are out on pasture. They have the ability to go to various types of shelter, including the two larger ones do get to have a choice of five shelters, if you will. I want to refer to them as a freedom stall, and how they oftentimes go to the same stall at a time. These guys particularly go to one or two of the shelters based on which way the wind or the storm's blowing. So they know how to get out of the bad weather if possible.
Mr. Geiger, can you wrap this up in about a minute?
Okay, yes. There was a couple points that some others brought forward. One person from the dairy industry talked about the value of a heifer calf at birth. I was just recently looking at the Capital Press that has this of the market and sales reports, for instance, at the Woodburn auction. Typically, the veal calves that you see that are in the veal situation are not the heifers that he was referring to. They go for about $500 a piece. The veal calves are typically the byproduct or the unwanted calves, the bull calves, for instance. According to the market report, they go for anywhere from $5 to $60 each. Oftentimes, on the crushing thing, when I first started my education and training, the litter size for pigs was only 8 to 10. They have now increased them, as reported. I think I just read briefly here that the litter size is now 10 to 14. Oftentimes, that results in smaller piglets, smaller, weaker piglets that are more susceptible to crushing, or the ability to get out of the way or from underneath the sow. Anyway, to wrap things up, I do believe that Senate Bill 694 is not only good for Oregon and our community, but it's good for our children, the ability to see kindness and compassion, and I urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 694. Thank you.
Very much. Okay.
Senator Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Jim Cron. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and my office is at 10505 Southwest Barber Boulevard here in Portland. The Oregon dairy industry, and I hope I'm able to give you maybe just a little bit different viewpoint of what you've heard today from just a slightly different perspective. The Oregon dairy industry, and really all Oregon livestock producers, realize that there are concerns from members of the general public when it comes to animal care. We respect and honor those concerns. The Oregon dairy industry believes that there must be a process developed to evaluate animal care issues. As we look at developing those animal care issues, we must gather all science and technology data available to make decisions about future directions that will, in the end, have a positive impact on the life of Oregon animals. In addition, changes in animal care are happening continually as science evolves and new technology comes forward. Finally, it's really important for us to realize that agricultural operations are complex ecosystems and must be treated as such. The Oregon dairy industry, along with Washington, have been working on the development of a five-pronged set of producer standards. This past summer, a strategic planning session of the dairy industry was held. From that process came a request by dairy producers to develop these standards. These standards center on the following areas: environment, food safety, labor, energy use, and animal care. Oregon dairy producers individually are using high levels of science and technology in these five standard areas. In the area of animal care, much time, dollars, and research have been invested by the dairy industry and other livestock producers in the areas of diet and nutrition, environmental adjustment depending on temperature and climate conditions, and animal comfort in many different types of housing. John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, during his distinguished life, described how each member of an ecosystem depends on the other. For example, a bird eats an insect, the bird drops feces, and other insects digest the feces, more bugs grow, and so does the foliage they live in. Remove one of these, and the ecosystem will be impacted. Mr. Muir used this analogy to describe his belief about ecosystems. Take a blanket and spread it out on the grass perfectly. No wrinkles, no nothing. Then gently pull at one corner, and you will discover that the entire blanket has changed. The Oregon dairy industry believes that animal care standards are vital to our industry and recognizes that there is a public concern. As an ecosystem, an agricultural operation must be aware of how small changes impact the whole of their operation. It is important to realize, first of all, there are no veal operations in Oregon today. Second of all, the only hog operations that exist in Oregon are very small family farmers. Senate Bill 694 looks at some very specific parts of veal and hog operations and not the entire operation or the ecosystem. The dairy industry realizes that Senate Bill 694 appears to be a piece of legislation that people believe is a solution to a problem. It might be valuable that as a committee, you consider that Senate Bill 694 might be simply tugging at the corner of the blanket. As elected members of the Oregon Senate, I think it's extremely important that you realize, after listening to the testimony that was given here today by everyone, no one has stated that in the state of Oregon these issues exist. Not one person. My hope is, as you look at this bill, you ask yourself, does it improve the life of farm animals in Oregon? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for your testimony. And I have a couple of other things. First of all, we're going to close the public hearing. on Senate Bill 694, and then I had some thank yous for the people who made this day possible. Dean Lydia Lauren, who welcomed us here today. Professor Steve Cantor is the one who masterminded this appearance today, and I really appreciate your work, Steve, wherever you are. I don't know if you like the Capitol where you... Oh, there you are. Good, you're in the room. And then, of course, the hard grunt work was done from behind the scenes by Linda Lopeman, Carla Almaraz, Linda Lewis, Gerald Wenzel, and Reggie Rayford. I want to thank you all for making this day really enjoyable and very, very educational. So thank you all.
And our staff
that we introduced earlier before. Senator Beyer.
Are you ready to adjourn?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I was just going to withdraw my notice of minority report.
Senator Beyer has withdrawn his notice of a minority report for Senate Bill 571. We are adjourned.